Hello, what's popping? My name is Ryan Jackson, and you're listening to the first episode of the Writing and Other Blood Sports podcast. This podcast is basically an excuse for me to sit down and shoot the shit and talk shop with other writers. And that's just what we do on this first episode with novelist Joey Hirsch. Joey is a very prolific writer who's written over 11 books, and I'm always fascinated with guys like that who can produce large bodies of work in a short period of time like he has. And we touch on that, and we touch on a lot of things, all types of topics. And if this podcast goes the way it's supposed to go, it should feel very conversational. The listeners should feel like they're right there in the room with us, listening along, having a beer. You might be asking yourself, what in the hell is writing and other blood sports mean? Well, it's taken from a title of a book on the craft of writing from novelist Charles Williford. Joey actually mentions the book in this first conversation. On this first episode, I had never even heard of this book until he actually mentioned it. I'm a fan of Charles Williford. Joey cites him as an influence, and as you'll hear, he mentions him multiple times. But the moment he said writing and other blood sports, I was immediately intrigued by that title. And I said, hey, I need to go ahead and co-opt that, straight up jack that for the name of the podcast, because I think nothing encapsulates what writing is to me than that title. Because writing is a blood sport. It's much like boxing. And you may be thinking, what the hell are you talking about? You don't get punched in the face. You don't get your ribs broke. You don't get knocked unconscious writing. Well, you're right. You don't. But when you sit down to write, if you're doing it right, you bleed every fucking time. So, without further ado, this is the first episode in my conversation with writer and friend Joey Hirsch. Enjoy. So, I just want to keep it, like, you know, super casual.
Oh, yeah, that's cool.
Like, conversational, you know what I mean? So,
that's fine.
I just fucking leave it recording and then we can just...
Okay. Am I close enough to it or...?
You should be. I mean, it's not going to be like we have individual mics, but it'll work.
You can ask me whatever, man.
So how many books have you written?
I don't know. I'm a quantity over quality guy, as I told you. I've written six... 11 books are published. One is I'm working on right now called Touch No One. And then I have a couple of novellas. One that was published, let me see if I can find it, House of Crystal, about a future in which crystal meth is basically the currency being used. That was the first thing I sold when I got out of the Army. I still like it, kind of. So I guess maybe 11 or 12 books. Two or three of them are good, maybe.
So that's like a novella?
Yeah.
A novella? That's cool. Like, I figure, like, my thing about it is, like, it seems to be, like, you're very prolific. And, like I was telling you earlier, like, I feel like there's two types of writers. There's the writers who are, like, extremely prolific. Mm-hmm. And there's the guys who kind of have, like the Juno Diaz disease. I like Juno Diaz a lot, but, like, he's one of those writers who, like, it takes him 7 years between each fucking book. You know what I mean? And
yeah, some of that could be the pressure of doing something that's great, maybe like if Salinger or Harper Lee or somebody who's written a great book, maybe, or you don't want to risk tarnishing that, or it's a lot of pressure. I don't think I've written anything horrible, but I don't think I've written anything that's good enough for me to kind of maintain radio silence.
Yeah,
there's some writer, I forget his name, he only wrote one novel, and someone said, why don't you write another one? And he said, did you like the first one? They said, yeah. And he said, read it again. If I did something that I thought was like The Great Gatsby, which I'm not going to do, I'd stop.
You'd stop?
I'd shut up. I'd keep writing, but I wouldn't publish.
You wouldn't publish it? Okay.
If I made enough money off of a book right now, I wouldn't publish anymore. I'd continue working, but I wouldn't inflict it on people anymore.
Yeah.
Because it's personal. It is really personal, weird shit that I'm just throwing out there. And I mean, a lot of people I know can read it, so it's awkward.
Yeah.
I just can't control it.
That's one of the things, like, honestly, truthfully, that's one of the things that I find myself fucking, like, battling with, is trying to learn how to be more prolific. Because, like, a fucking, one of the things that I think about, and even though I'm, like, focusing mostly on just screenplays, mm-hmm. is just that, like, which is absurd, because the screenplay is, like, not even a finished, you know what I mean? It's not even, it's going to be rewritten 100 times, but it's, like, the blueprint of another fucking thing. It's such the,
right.
so fucking weird, but, like, that's still that level of preciousness is, like, something that, like, I have to continuously fight, like, all the time.
You mean trying to make something perfect?
Trying to make something perfect, yeah, like, almost trying to make, like, the perfect thing on the first fucking try. Like, and like, allowing yourself to, like, just let it be what it is. It's, like, I'm one of those people who, like, I have to accept that, like, I'm going to have shitty writing, mm-hmm. you know, to get to the good writing. But, like, accepting that it's shitty has always been, like, a fucking really hard thing for me to, like, get beyond that. You know what I mean? Like, how did you know, like, you have to, like, shut that off. You have right. to shut off that inner editor.
Critique.
Yeah, that inner editor. And that's the biggest challenge for me personally in anything I write, is always, like, telling the internal editor to shut the fuck up. You know what I mean?
It's basically my mm-hmm. only, my main form of entertainment. So there's that analogy that Bukowski had where he said, you know, when I write, that's like inhaling the cigarette. The book is the ash. So I look at, I'm not like Richard Price where he says, you know, I like the feeling of being done with writing more than I like writing.
Mm-hmm.
I look at the process as the high. And then the book is the after effects of the buzz that I was chasing.
Yeah.
So it's what the book is just the husk of whatever buzz I got while sitting there.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's, people say, why are you prolific? It's because I like feeling good. I like the feeling of mm-hmm. sitting there. And then just after that, the aftermath is that a book is existing there. It's like sex, you know, people enjoy it, but then a baby is there.
Yeah.
And it's the same.
And I always look at people that say that, like, there's, like, I'm always the motherfucker who does that. There's two types. I hate people that say there's two types of people, because there's way more than two types of people.
Right.
But there's, again, that's another thing where it's like there's two types of writers. Those who like writing and those who love having written.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I definitely fall into the camp of like, I love having written because mm-hmm. the process is so fucking arduous.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like there's moments during it, like when I'm writing, I'm like, oh, that was great,
right.
that I enjoy. But it's like such a fucking like a hair-pulling experience, like, as you go through as you get through further and further and further and further. And then there's times when you hit, like, that flow state where shit is just great, and you're, like, you're loving that. Like, I chase that.
Right.
Like, I chase that during the process, like, and that usually takes, personally, that takes me, like, hours. Like, I have to be, like, locked into something for hours to reach that state.
Right.
And then I reach it, and then, like, it's just, everything's fun. Like, you know what I mean? Everything, it just comes out. I'm no longer second-guessing everything. I'm no longer, you know what I mean? And shit just, I'm actually recording stream of conscious thought, know what I mean?
It's like boxing. I mean, there's slow starters and people who come out of the gate swinging, but I mean, it's
how do you think, like, writing, and this is kind of like a fucking, like, we kind of touched on this a little bit, but how do you think writing has ultimately affected, like, your life in terms of, like, your relationships and all that shit?
It's distracted. If I ever really allowed myself to think about what I've done with my life, the mistakes I've made, the war, physical problems and things, I'd probably commit suicide. So, you know, without hyperbole, without it, yeah, I'd definitely be dead. But at the same time, I wonder what it would be like if I'd never had, it's a sickness, something you're born with. If I'd never written, I think I have this fantasy, you know, I have wife, kids, I'm like a doctor, we go to church once a week, we go out, you know, I have this fantasy, so I have this feeling that writing saved me and destroyed my life. So the answer, what would it be like? Either a lot better or a lot worse.
Yeah.
That's not a satisfying answer, but I don't
like,
know.
I'm very wary of, like, people who, you know, writers specifically, who appear to have, like, all their shit together.
Mm-hmm.
Like, who appear to have, like, these great relationships, because, like, I don't know anybody, at least anybody whose work I fucking respect,
mm-hmm.
like, who doesn't have these like relationship issues.
King seems pretty stable. We were talking about
Stephen King. Yeah, he does, but you have to look at his situation as he literally has a whole entire family full of writers.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? His wife Tabitha's a writer, both his sons are a writer, you know what I mean? Like literally he's surrounded by everybody has to, so everybody kind of respects that process,
right?
And it works, but typically most writers don't, you know, I don't know. I don't want to speak in generalizations, but it seems like most writers, whoever they decide to be with as their significant other, mm-hmm. ends up being somebody who's not necessarily a writer themselves. So they're not all the way on board, or they just don't fucking understand it. And, like, there becomes, like, me personally, I know, like, my relationships have suffered. All my relationships have suffered because of writing, honestly.
Yeah.
You know, not to mention that, like, writing, like I was telling you earlier, like, writing is for people who tend to be in their head, you know what I'm saying? It's mm-hmm. a good, it's like, that's the mode that you're already in, and writing just reinforces that. Like, you know what I mean? Writing reinforces that. Since me being, like, a product of, like, I got the middle child syndrome and the fucking loner thing going, like, I've always had that. Like, right. just, I was just always the dude who's like, I'm gonna do my own thing off over here. So, once I started writing, like, I realized, like, oh, like, it's just me doing that, more of that all the fucking time.
Right.
And, like, needing my space and my alone time is, like, pushes other people the fuck away.
Yeah, you know I mean? Arthur Clarke, a lot of people said, Arthur Clarke said writing is at most a part-time job. I think Bukowski and Spike Lee said they can write 2 or 3 hours, and then that third hour sort of dissipates into nothingness.
Yeah.
But then you have to factor in editing, revising, submissions, answering right. other people, and then reading. So that's 8 to 10 hours a day.
Probably, right. And I hear people say that, mm-hmm. but I always call bullshit on it, because I'm like, no, dude, I'm writing all the time, right. even if I'm not. Because, like, all, like you said, you walking around going through your data, it's always in the back of your head.
That was Charles Williford with his wife. He said, she said, you're always sitting around. He says, no, when the words are bubbling up when I'm just sitting there, that's writing too, the gestation. It's like pregnancy. Women probably wouldn't appreciate that. Maybe it's like pregnancy.
And that's, I'm really obsessed with, like, other writers' processes and, like, how they do it. Because, like, it's one of the things that, like, I understand it ultimately, like, it doesn't matter how you get there, as long as you get there.
Right.
But I'm always, like, curious, like, what's the day to day? So, like, what's your day to day when you know what I mean? I know that you say that you, like, it's for you, it's just an obsession, and you write nonstop. But, like, what does that look like? You know,
a lot of stretching, a lot of you set up a lot of pauses so that you go for walks. A lot of people don't use music, and then certain people have certain soundtracks, like Jean Cocteau constructed this entire soundtrack of what he listened to when he wrote. My friend John does not listen to any music. I listen to echoes. I listen to a lot of classical music. I'm a research junkie. I guess I torture myself with research so that I don't have as much fear when I'm actually working, because I'm just relieved to not be researching and actually be writing. It's kind of like training in the gym to deal with your nerves.
Use the research phase as, like, a means of procrastination? Because me personally, like, that's my crack. Like, procrastination is, like, whatever I can do to put off the writing, I'm going to do it. Like, until
I set a certain number of books to read, and once I'm at that limit, let's say, hypothetically, I wanted to write about tennis. I'd pick out 10 or 20 books on tennis and read them, and after that, if I make a mistake in the text for somebody who really knows tennis inside out, that's fine, as long as it works for the narrative. But no, because if I wait more than 2 or 3 months, the itch, just I just feel like I'm not justifying my existence.
Right.
I can't do that.
So how long would it take you to read all those books, typically, you know what I mean, before you started writing?
20 books, research, about 2 months. Maybe.
About 2 months. Yeah. And then how long from once you start writing to a finished draft, typically, would it take you?
Between 60,000 words and 110,000 words. I think Kentucky Beast Theory is my longest book, 108,000 words. Yeah. I would say between 2 weeks and a month.
2 weeks and a month. That's not bad. That's pretty fast.
Yeah, the writing, I guess it's similar to film production, where there's a lot of pre-production, then you shoot for like 28 days, and then there's a lot of editing. So, I mean, the actual process of writing is the most fun part, and it's also the shortest
part. How much emphasis do you take, like, on, like, me personally, like, I'm a big style person.
Right.
Like, I'm very conscious of this style in which I'm writing at. Mm-hmm. And, like, that's probably that probably takes me the longest. It doesn't matter what I'm writing. Like, I'm like, okay, I'm going to write it in this style.
Right.
So therefore, like, that's the fixation. Do you, like, ever think about that when you're writing? Like, in terms of, like, I'm writing it...
I guess I got where I got. Everybody does this, I think. You sort of mimic people.
You mimic people.
Then you find your own ways that don't work, and then finally you accidentally become you. So I have my own style. I would say it's a weird mix. It switches from really basic, prosaic, simple prose to like super intricate stuff for a second, and then it switches back and forth. So it's like Lovecraft mixed with Jim Thompson. It's really weird because I read everything, so it comes out strange. It's just organic. I don't plan it.
I found the same thing. Like, I started out like that and then kind of found my own thing. Mm-hmm. But like, it's like a fucking rhythm. Like, it's a rhythm I know. Like, you know what I mean?
Right.
And it's like, until I hit that rhythm, mm-hmm. it's like, it's off. You know what I mean?
I'm not sure if you remember, have you read Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas?
Yes, yeah.
Remember, there's one passage that Thompson loved. He called it the wave, and he would always read it.
Mm-hmm.
It is like boxing, where there are pockets where it's boring and it's not working, and then mm-hmm. You hit this thing that really works and you don't understand it, and it just lasts for a short time. So, I mean, yeah, you do mm-hmm. get in the... I do know what you're talking about, the rhythm, but it's not something that I sustain. It's something mm-hmm. I accidentally fall into.
Yeah, yeah. And that's because me personally, like... I don't give a... Like, I care about story. I'm not one of those people who doesn't care about story.
Right.
But I care about, like, the voice more than anything. Like, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. it's, like, because that's the one thing that, like, I can do me, no one else can do me. Like, you can do you, no one else can do you. It's the one thing, you know what I'm saying? That's, like, your fingerprint.
There are a lot of people mm-hmm. who have very similar styles to each other, though.
Yeah.
But, and if... most of the people, when they're looking at these free book in exchange for review thing, they're looking for something in the tradition of, you know, like Tom Clancy. They're looking for someone who's done something that's been done before.
Before, right.
So if you're not doing that, it will, what's his name? Charles Williford said, basically, if you want to be a pro writer, you can do it in 3 to 5 years. Just study what other people do and do it.
Do it, yeah.
Or you can do exactly what you want to do, and you will eventually get paid to do it. But rather than 3 to 5 years, it might be 40.
Yeah.
You can
and
do it.
And it's one of those things, too. I totally agree with that. Like, one of the things that I've noticed is, like, trying to find, like, that even ground of trying to, like, appear to make something that appears familiar, mm-hmm. but then, like, infuse the elements that are you in it.
Right.
Kind of, like, sneak that shit in there.
Right.
So then, at the end of the day, you have something that's familiar but yet unique, you know?
It's not intentional for me. There's a guy, I don't know if you've ever heard, like, The Soft Machine, Robert Wyatt. He's a musician. Mm-hmm. He's one of my favorite... Everybody says he's very, like, surrealistic and progressive. He says, I wanted to be Ray Charles. I try to be as normal as in pop as possible. It just comes out weird.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't have a problem just being another mass market guy, but every time I try to do something that's just straight sci-fi or Western, some weird personal element to, like, my sexuality or something just ends up in there. I can't control it. I want to be like everybody else.
I found this in my own shit. Mm-hmm. I see it across the board, a lot of writers. Like, do you find that, like, subconsciously, when you look back, you're literally writing, even though it's completely different? It could be a completely different genre. It could be a completely different makeup of characters within your story.
Sure.
Like, you're always telling the same story. Like, on some level. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. There's the Coen brothers. Somebody came up to them and said, all of your movies are basically about a weaker man being pulled aside by a stronger man and saying, hey, do this, do that. Like, Big Lebowski, Raising Arizona. Post-hoc, looking at a lot of my stuff, something about, like, a substance keeps coming up. Like, either it's blood, or in this new one, it's breast milk. I have no clue what it means, but it just keeps some sort of magical... fluid or something. I have no clue what the hell it means, but yeah, there's some thematic thread through all of my work, but I'm not sure exactly what it is, and it's not conscious. If I ever feel like where Stephen King said he wrote from a Buick gate, it was too similar to Christine. If I ever get to the point where I think I'm just writing the same book twice, I'll call it a day.
You'll just call it a day. Well, you seem to be very all over the map, which is a good thing, I think. Like, you're very, like, none of your books tend to be, like you said, the Bastards, Grimoire is a totally, like, different
fantasy.
Yeah, it's like fucking George R. R. Martin, like, fucking on an acid of some, like, you know what I mean? Like, with mixed with, like, fucking a Hennenlotter film.
Yeah.
You know, like, and then, of course, then you have stuff like Veterans Affair, which, you know, which is told from, obviously, from a point of view of someone who actually, you know, was in combat. Then you have Dove Crow. I remember you reading that.
Oh, yeah, with Scott.
Yeah, at Scott Phillips at the library, which is a fucking Western.
Right.
It's like you're just...
Weird Western.
Weird Western. Like, how many, like, I know you don't. Do you consider yourself any type of genre writer, or do you just consider yourself just, I'm just a writer?
If people want to lump me into these genres or compare my works to other works in the genres, that's cool with me. But somebody either complained or complimented Veterans Affairs. They said it's too slipstream. It's not bird or beast. It's neither fish nor fowl. The only thing I think I've written that could be categorized as really like literary or general fiction would probably be Up in the Treehouse, coming of age story. If people want to categorize me as crime or westerns or whatever, I don't think genre fiction is ghettoized the way it was. You know, people like Philip Dick have sort of rehabilitated it. So I don't see myself as a literary writer. I have problems people saying, oh, he writes horror and SF or something.
And it's kind of like, you know how like you do the term, like, genre fiction used to be, like you said, ghettoized and looked down upon. But, like, in popular culture now, that's, like, everything.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's become, like, mainstream. Like, at one point, it's, like, all of the like... all of the shit we consume now is like some sort of like this derivative of some existing material that started out as like what you would consider, you know, back in the day when literary types would look down upon, like, all like Game of Thrones is one of the biggest things in the fucking world right now.
Some people, you know,
break
the barriers, like Umberto Eco. He wrote The Name of the Rose. He was considered an esoteric literary writer, but for some reason became a massive bestseller. So you can't always predict sometimes the masses like literary stuff.
Right. Yeah. I think that, like, I'm one of those people who, like, I don't know, like, I don't like to draw the distinctions, like, between shit. You know what I mean? Like, I'll read a fucking Jonathan Franzen novel, and then I'll fucking read a fucking Lee Child fucking... You know what I mean? Like,
I could never get into Franzen. I don't want to badmouth him. It's just, he's one of those...
You can badmouth him.
I couldn't read The Corrections.
I read The Corrections, and it was... I felt the same way.
I like some middle-brow writers. I guess they'd be classical. Now I'm probably insulting them. I like Tom Perrotta. Do you know him?
Yeah,
I like Tom Perrotta. I like Richard Price.
Yeah.
And technically, they would be, I guess, considered middle-brow.
Middle-brow.
But for, like, Tom Wolfe, Sal Bello, sort of establishment writers, I tried reading Norman Mailer's fiction. It's just...
I tried
Mailer. Martin Amis, I can't get into.
Hemingway?
A little bit. I prefer Nathaniel West or Fitzgerald from that time period, but I'm not a big Lost Generation guy or a Beat guy even. I like people who aren't even parts of movements, who are just kind of out on their own.
Yeah.
Sort of like Charles Williford.
Yeah.
So, not that those people always had a choice. They got group post-hop these groups.
So you mentioned Williford a few times. Is he a big influence on you?
Yeah. I mean, he's a big mystery because I think there are, again... We were talking about there are two types of books, or probably millions of types, but I mean there are two types of books basically with great books. There are the ones you go back and you reread them, and it's like the prestige has been exposed, and then you know, they're not as good for some reason the second or third time, and then there are the ones that are still good every time. They're like a mystery; they get better every time. Mm-hmm. Williford, there's some weird mystery at the heart of him. It's some of it is his biography. It's just he spent 20 years in the army. And nobody spends 20 years in the army and comes out as a writer like him. And I mean, he was, you know, his biography is just hard to believe. Most people, they just go from high school, college, MFA. So that he had so much life experience compared to most people. And he had a really strong sense of humor, and he wrote in a bunch of genres. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know. So you're in school.
Yes, sir.
You're going for your master's, right?
Yeah.
In literature?
German studies.
German studies?
Like, yeah. Okay. I was stationed in the army in Germany for a little while. I got my GED and started delivering pizzas and working in factories and things like that.
Yeah.
I guess my family was upper middle class, but I was, I guess, a massive underachiever. I'd never thought I'd even go to college, get a 2-year degree. I just thought I'd write a few things and commit suicide. I thought it was done after. I sold a bunch of short stories to Underground Voices. And after that, I just got fat and went to a mental hospital for a while after the war. So I thought it was over, and then all of a sudden I wrote like 12 books.
Well, we'll get back to that mental hospital thing real quick, but I was going to ask you basically, like, do you think, like, and I had actually had someone ask me this question, and this is why I'm asking it, because I think it's a very, like, a question that, like, probably people would ask. Do you think, because I've been asked it, do you think that, like, what's your opinion on, like, people who go to school to write? Because me personally, I don't think it fucking matters. Mm-hmm. And, like, a lot of the guys who, like, I look up to or whose shit I really dig, they fucking never set foot in a fucking, you know, creative writing class.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
One of my favorite writers, guy who helped me a lot with my career, John Shepard, he did his MFA under Harry Cruz.
Mm-hmm.
I know Richard Price taught at Columbia, so I know that those who teach or those who can't do teach is not true.
Yeah.
But at the same time, in order to really write, honestly, I think you have to be willing to violate a lot of taboos. David Cronenberg was talking about this. Obviously, as a person in society, you're obligated to be a good citizen. Stop at stoplights, respect other people.
Yeah.
But your artistic obligation is to be a bad citizen. And, and part of going to university is being correctly socialized and learning the correct attitudes to have. And if I had gone to the university before the army, before the factories, before delivering pizzas and stuff, I don't think there'd be enough reality in my work. That's just me personally.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, when I'm writing, I'm not thinking, oh, is a woman going to say this is sexist? Is a man going to say, is a black man going to say this is racist or something? And what I found is, yeah, my work is really offensive, but not a lot of people are being offended on someone else's behalf, like where Crumb was asked by Terry Zwigoff, you know, do you get criticism for the way you draw black people? He said, yeah, all from white liberals. So it's the same thing. Yeah, I'm a mess and I'm offensive, but I'm honest, and I don't know that I'd be that honest if I went to school when I was younger and acquired the correct attitudes. I'm already molded, so I can't be reformed.
Yeah, yeah. See, that's kind of what I feel about it. I feel like I kind of feel like writers are born.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I don't know if you feel that same way.
They have to be, because there are people with exciting lives who write horrible books, and there are people with boring lives who write great books.
Like, right.
Bukowski was a dishwasher, but
right.
I mean, his books are great.
I think everyone inherently has like a sense of like the ability to tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't necessarily mean they're writers. You know what I mean?
I'd say about a fifth of the population could probably make a living as a writer,
mm-hmm.
but they don't want to do the rewriting, editing, submission, and all that shit.
Right. So. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, human beings, most of them can tell a story. It's just the other bullshit.
Yeah, it's that's what separates the men from the boys.
Okay.
But I do think it's kind of like one of those things that, like, it's like the 90-mile-an-hour fastball. I use that analogy a lot. Mm-hmm. Like, either fucking you got it or you don't.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, or in boxing, a chin, certain things can't be taught.
Yeah,
yeah, I mean, we talk about On Writing by Stephen King. Somebody with a modest amount of talent who works really hard, I think, will do better than someone with a lot of talent who just drinks himself silly and doesn't take their craft seriously.
How much, now that I'm not, obviously I'm stumbling over my words, but
no,
like we were saying, you know, writers are born, but how much life experience do you think it's necessary for you to actually write something of worth? Because I know for a fact that writing is something I could always do,
right?
But I didn't have shit to say until like I actually went through shit.
Sure.
And like I look at, for example, remember you ever read The Basketball Diaries?
Yeah, by Carol.
For that, he's a kid, but if you read that shit, like look at all the shit he went through.
Right.
You know what
right.
I mean? Like life requires you to actually have experience adversity and go through fucking shit in order to have anything worth saying on the page.
Right.
You know, how much do you think that like that's a necessary requirement? Like you have to have that in order to write? You know, because I think most people would say yes, but then I know some people, they're like, no, we just make shit up. And I'm like, yeah, but, like, it comes off as you just made shit up.
Yeah, I mean, I can only speak from, it's a good question, but from personal experience, I think living really hard for 3 or 4 years and then withdrawing from life completely is a really good idea. Like, Ferdinand Céline, he was in the First World War. I don't know if you've read Journey to the End of the Night.
Yeah.
It's basically, I mean, just throwing yourself into life really hard and then withdrawing after you've seen how bad and how good it can get, it's probably the best idea.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, you'd have to do the Marvin Monroe thing from The Simpsons. Take a guy, put him in a chamber, and just give him literature and don't let him live a life, and then let him write and see if he can create something.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good question, but I can't really answer it. I know the army taught me how a massive swath, cross section of Americans talk from like the Bronx to Iowa, which I would not have gotten sitting in Cincinnati. So it exposed me to a lot of different kinds of people. I got hurt, but you know, I'm still alive. Yeah, I mean, it's probably important to get hurt a little bit before you start.
So you said you were in a mental hospital.
yeah, I can talk about that. That was, as a teenager, I had some problems, and I mean, I was just, like, suicidal. My dad's a shrink. And then after the war, you know, I went into the hospital for PTSD a few times, just sort of breaking down, just sort of having sort of panic attacks and things like that. Yeah, I mean, there are mental hospital scenes in maybe 2 or 3 of my books. Probably Veterans Affairs deals with insanity. It's more panic than anything else, but it's... You know, but when people talk about contemplating suicide, that to me sounds like a 70-year-old man who's doing a cost-benefit analysis. His wife's gone or something. Whereas with me, it's just like a panic of just, holy shit, I'm scared. Let me jump off this bridge.
Did you sell you? So, like, what did you really, inside the mental hospital, did you have, like, a One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest type fucking
No, they're very, no, it's not, like, draconian or anything. Mm-hmm. Very, no, I mean, I was at the VA here and a couple of other ones. It's it's not a bad experience. It's just kind of cooling down, you know, just reading, listening to music, walking.
Yeah.
Some of the RNs are attractive. that's about it.
So how much, I mean, obviously you mentioned the PTSD, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? How has that affected your writing? You know,
I probably shouldn't say this. I think it's probably made it better, because it's you know, it's therapeutic to do it. I mean, I feel, I've told somebody that PTSD is just like a permanent second pubescence. You know, all of your confidence is gone. You're really awkward. You shake. Things that shouldn't induce fear induce fear. That's how I've explained somebody to explain PTSD to somebody, is your fear nodes or whatever are switched so that things that shouldn't be scary, like somebody pointing a gun at you, things that should be scary, like someone pointing a gun at you, aren't scary. Talking to someone or having dinner with somebody is scary.
So yeah.
I don't know why. It's just, there's a constant, my fight and flight receptors are just fried from the war, so I try to spend as much time as I can alone because it's just too awkward.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to make other people uncomfortable with my sadness or whatever. Not sadness, just damage.
Yeah. Yeah. How is, how has that been as far as, like, in terms of just your everyday life, like, interacting with people and, you know, do you feel like, I was trying to think, do you feel, like you said, you know it helps your writing, but, like, is it one of those things, too, that, like, hinders you just, I guess you kind of answered that in a way already, but... You know, in terms of your relationships with people and.
Yeah. I mean, I wrote about it in Veterans Affairs, so I might as well say it. I mean, for a while I couldn't have sex, you know, because you know, they were selling Viagra in Iraq. I mean, if there's too much violence, you get too stressed to have sex. Or yeah, I mean, obviously, it will affect your ability to be with women. I'd rather actually admit that, so just to scare anybody who's listening out of joining the army, because yeah. they have this romantic notion. It's better to be honest about that kind of stuff. But no, I'm in much better shape than a lot of other guys. I was at Launchstuhl Medical Facility in Heidelberg, and I saw guys who, you know, can't walk and things like that. So
no.
I got fucked up, but it was an elective experience. There was no draft. I was curious.
No.
I didn't believe in the reasons for the war. It was a personal curiosity thing.
Yeah.
So I can't complain. I have a lot of physical pain, but I have a good disability rating. I get massage and stuff like that.
What happened to you as far as, like, how did you get injured?
We were on a convoy, vehicle broke down, I was jacking the vehicle, it was one of these T-bar jacks, it might be hard to describe without being able to show people, but basically I put a lot of tension on the jack and it just came free and my hand sort of hit the concrete with all this torque, and then it was just accumulation of weight. I mean, guys lose 2 or 3 inches off their height in certain military occupation skills like tankers and things.
Mm-hmm.
I had squad automatic weapon, spare barrel, night vision goggles, 400 rounds. Water, hydration source, sappy plates, ballistic vests, and I'm probably leaving out. Yeah, I am. Communication security equipment. So I had about 100 to 150 pounds worth of shit on me, jumping out of helicopters. Jesus. And walking around. So, I mean, it just wore me down. I was, like I said, I don't belong anywhere in society. I come from an upper middle class family, worked in factories, was an enlisted man in the army. Now getting my master's with a bunch of books published. I don't have a peer group. You know, I have me my dog.
I totally relate to that in terms of, like, feeling like you don't have a peer group. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I think a lot of writers do, honestly. I just think that's just kind of, like, the personality is. And I don't necessarily... I see it from all different backgrounds. Me, myself, personally, you know, I know that being from a multiracial background,
mm-hmm.
definitely informs who I am more so than I ever admitted to myself until I got older, because, like, I've always been that person that's, like, walked between two worlds.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have my father, who's an African-American, that sounds so fucking cool, a black guy.
Yeah.
And my mom, who's a upper middle class white woman from Mason, Ohio.
Well, I mean, your dad's class background then, is he not from
working,
the same class?
No, general, oh, working
that's,
class.
That's as big, yeah. Well, I don't know if that's as big as Grace, that's probably not.
And you're talking about, like, working class, like, just from a, you know, urban, you know, area, and my mother, who's from the most suburban-y of suburban places. Right. So you have that dichotomy of, like, you know, that side of the family and the other side of the family, and just being so used to that and being so raised in a situation where, like, that's not a thing. You know what I mean? Yeah.
That's hard because I think most people would be, I mean, I don't know, but I think most people are envious of that at this point. I mean, at least in public, because if you look at, like, commercials, what they're saying they're looking for is somewhat of indeterminate ethnicity.
Right.
And it's just, I guess it's hip or chic, but I mean, that's not the same as living.
Yeah. So and it's one of those things, too, that, like, again, like, I never thought of it until, like, I got older, but, like, I noticed the change, you know what I mean? Like, considering, like, where I came from, like, my peer group from, like, elementary school and then all black, basically all black elementary school to, like, the jump to the junior high school where it started to intermix to high school. And just seeing, like, literally having that ability to switch. Like, you know what
code
I mean?
Code switching, they call
yeah,
it.
Yeah, switch. Like, I can be sitting there talking to this group, and then, like, you know what I mean? Kind of like we were making fun of, like, off mic, we were saying before over the phone, we were talking about, like, the Tarantino thing with.
Oh, yeah.
Where, like, he's on BET and he's putting on that
or
black.
Sway,
yeah.
Check it out. I give props.
Yeah, he's doing the patois. Okay. He's doing the fucking, you know, like, he's like, I feel like I adapt like that, like, unconsciously. So, like, making fun of him is kind of funny because, like, I feel like if I'm around certain dudes, then that shit comes out. You know what I'm saying? Like, that, the fucking, the N-bombs fly, the nigga, and all that shit. And then I'm around, like, other people and it's like, oh, yeah, I'm just normal. I'm just a typical motherfucker. You know what I mean?
I wish I could probably segue more because, I mean, I go to school and everybody who's at the school in the master's program is teaching as well. And I can read. I love to read. You know, I love to do research.
Yeah.
But I can't. In German, they call it the Schleimerei. Literally means the sliming, which is sort of the social aspect. I can't schleim. I don't know how to.
I just
if I try to talk to somebody, it's like there's a fart in the room. It just shuts everybody up. It's like a faux pas.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you can switch, probably, I mean, you don't feel like you're being deceptive or something.
No, it's just, it's natural. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's very natural.
In either way,
though, it's like that awkwardness that exists, you know what I'm saying? It exists in both planes. It doesn't really matter. So it's like, it's just, there's a switch, but I still feel the same.
So do you feel uncomfortable with it, or do you feel comfortable in your own skin, or?
I would say yeah, and then I would say no. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's like, and maybe it's some shit I'm figuring out. You know what I mean? Like, even now in my 30s, I'm still kind of like, there's times where I'm like, yeah, and then there's times like, I don't know. Like, and
but
I just.
You've got kids though, right?
Yeah, I've got kids.
So you can't let them know that you have an insecurity, like, racially, can you? Because you don't want them to get a mania.
And here's the thing, I've never categorized it as an insecurity, and I still don't think it's an insecurity. I think my insecurities are human insecurities. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't think it's identifiable by race. I just think that the race component, like, is something that, like, I notice now as I'm older, that, like, oh, like, I shift between these worlds, so I don't see, like, lines like people see. You know what I mean? Like, I obviously acknowledge them because I shift, but, like, they never, you know what I mean? Like, I it's something that I just now started to notice, like, and so it's like it never really, it's weird, like, you know what I mean? Like, I think, like, all of the insecurities that I have are just human shit. Like, you know what I mean? Like everybody has. You know what I mean? Like, just in the context of, like, just being around people. Like, there's circumstances and situations where I'm just chill. I'm comfortable.
Right.
You know what I mean? And then there's just situations where I'm not. Where I'm like, everything feels like a fucking, you know, like, I'm watching what I say. I'm watching what I do. I'm very hyper aware, you know, because I'm self-conscious. And I don't think any of it stems from race, but I think that, like, that has to play some role. You know what I mean? And that's another thing, like, as I've been writing more, like, I've been trying to, like, internalize, you know, the things that I've been going, like, and trying to maybe somehow speak about those things because for some reason it's there, you know?
Well, Chester Himes said there's such a thing as a white mind or a black mind.
Yeah.
Do you think if you were reading a screenplay blind that wasn't, like, explicitly about race, that you could tell either the person's sex or race just by reading it? Like, if it was just something neutral where it wasn't, like, say, a civil rights thing or something?
I would like to say yeah. I would like to think I would be able to, mm-hmm. but I'm pretty sure there's examples where I'd be dead wrong.
Right.
You know what I mean? And again, it depends on the writer. Right. Like you said, that dual mind thing, that like having a black mind or a white mind. What if it's a black writer who has the so-called white mind?
Well, Haim said it's mm-hmm. easy to encounter a black person with a white mind, but not vice versa. But that was in the 30s or 40s where, I mean, yeah. it was more of a central
Haim's
power
one
system.
Of my favorites, too.
Yeah, he's yeah, very good. Yeah. He was a big Williford was a big fan of his. He wrote a bunch about Haim's in a book called Writing and Other Blood Sports.
Yeah. He's another writer that like went to jail.
Yeah, I mean yeah. He
started writing in jail, right?
Yeah, he started out upper middle classy family, mm-hmm. Went to a historically black college, mm-hmm. And decided his family owned laundromats, and he decided to rob a jewelry store, I believe,
mm-hmm.
and that's what Williford talks about. He says he locked the couple into the room for. Into the bathroom or something for 20 minutes, and he got 20 years a year for every minute.
Yeah.
And he worked in a hotel, and he fell into an elevator shaft when the car wasn't there, and he thought he was paralyzed. Yeah. I think he blinded his brother on accident. Yeah.
I think I started to read the Quality Chester Himes, the one that James Salas wrote.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I couldn't get through it. I like James Salas, but I just couldn't get through it.
You can get a better picture of Himes from his own work, probably.
Yeah. But I'm definitely a fan of, like, I think his detective shit is...
The Gravedigger.
The Gravedigger and Coffinhead. I love that shit.
I'm not sure if he ever... Somebody told me it was, like, Stoker with Dracula. Like, he'd never been to Transylvania. Like, somebody said
mm-hmm.
Himes didn't really know much about Harlem. It was just, like, the Harlem in his imagination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, no, he's I like a lot of pulpy stuff like him. But he wrote some mm-hmm. social protest shit, too. Like, what was it? Damn it, the Quality of Hurt or something like that.
Mm.
And then he wrote about his prison experiences. It was initially it was called Cast the First Stone, and they re-released it as Yesterday Will Make You Cry. Lonely Crusade is his big communist thingy, like Richard Wright.
Yeah. So while we're on it, like, well, who's some of your favorite writers? You know.
It's a wide net. I like Jakob Grimmelhausen. He's a German writer from the 16th century. He wrote a lot about the 30 Years' War. I like Philip Dick. I like Stephen King. I like Ursula Le Guin. I like Chester Himes. I like Charles Williford. One of my favorite writers of all time is John Fante. If I had to pick, a lot of people don't know about him. In technical terms, I'd say the best writer of all time is a Russian named Ivan Bunyan. He wrote, if you get this book of short stories, it's called Sunstroke and Other Stories, or The Gentleman from San Francisco and Other Stories. He, I think, is the best writer, but I like Fante a lot. You don't see very much emotion in writing. Like, I mean, it's too painful to deal with reality, and his writing's full of emotion.
I'm trying to think of who I would say off the top of my head.
Is your favorite?
My favorite. Definitely King definitely goes in there. Yeah. Just in terms of just influence, you know what I mean? Like, I think he's influenced all of us, you know what I mean?
He's
like,
gotten the last laugh on the establishment.
Yeah, he's definitely got an influence. I really like... Chester Himes, I've already mentioned Chester Himes. Yeah, that's definitely a favorite of mine. In terms of, like, I'm happy because I write scripts, obviously. I like a lot of screenwriters' work, and I like Shane Black, obviously.
You like Schrader?
Paul Schrader's good, especially his old stuff. You know,
I've seen the movies, but I don't know what the
scripts. Yeah, like I'm trying to think. His Rolling Thunder script was good.
Oh, that's in Tarantino's top 10.
Yeah, I liked his script for Taxi Driver.
What do you think of Kubrick? He said a script is I think he said it's like a piece of craftsmanship, but not art. Like, but then Hitchcock, I think he said the movie is if the screenplay's good, the movie's already good. There.
I disagree. I think that I love Kubrick, but like. If you read a script by these guys, if you read a script by Aaron Sorkin,
mm-hmm.
like you can take his name off the fucking page,
right.
Like you, it's there. Like you know, it's there. If you read a script by even like someone like Diablo Cody, like her voice is so, like all those movies
mm-hmm.
that you see, like yeah, they have directors, but like her voice is like it's almost like you can't erase her voice. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's an art. It's like it's almost like I look at it as like I look at it as like it's like. Saying the most in the fewest words possible, like
haiku,
you know what I mean? It's like haiku, yeah. Like Walter Hill, for example, had that extreme haiku style
in Hard Times.
Yeah, Hard Times, like one of the. I love that script because it's like you can read it and it's just like it literally looks like a fucking haiku. You know what I mean? It's just his script for like he had a whole bunch of scripts like that, like a. Hard Times is probably the most extreme, but then he had, like, the script for Driver was like that.
Yeah, that's very minimalist, too.
Very minimalist. I've seen that movie. His script for, I'm trying to think, the Alien script was. when he rewrote it, it
he
was
and Dan Bannon.
Him and Dan O'Bannon. Like, there was a script that pre-existed that Dan O'Bannon had already wrote with another guy.
Didn't he write
I think
Dark
it was William
Star?
Guiler yeah. or David Guiler.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, like, him, like, he rewrote it, and, like, soon as the Hill version, like, the Walter Hill version, like, that style is there. Like, that's the, he, like, I love that, like, punchy, quick, you know what I mean, being able to sum it up, like, to me, that's the best type of script writing, like, that stripped down, spare. But there's guys who, like, I love who just write, like, like, there's a guy, Brad Inglesby. He wrote that movie, Run All Night. Right. He also, the movie that became, it became Under the Furnace. It started out as a script that circled around Hollywood called The Low Dweller.
Right.
His screenwriting is a lot like prose. Like, you know what I mean? It's like, he'll even, one of his scripts is called, I think it's called A Woman on Fire. Mm-hmm. Like, he's literally saying, like, the character's backstory on the page, like she was molested when she was two, and she was, I mean, she didn't say right. that, but like shit that you would, like, that's totally unfilmable, that you wouldn't get away with.
Right.
Like, he has a very, like, literary style, and he gets away with it because he's became like this Inglesby. He's became that, like,
but did he start out like that? I mean, or did he,
the Low Dweller was the script that pushed him through.
Oh, okay.
Like, it was, I think he's from Indiana, like, that script got, like, him in the door, it sold. It was, you know, and then he started writing more scripts, and his style is there. So, like, he's already established. He sold a bunch of scripts. Once you make a name for yourself, you're able right. to get away with a lot of shit. Like, if you start out like that, like, people are gonna be like, no, you can't do that. You know what I mean? And, until somebody takes the chance and says, this is good shit. Then in Hollywood, in my experience, is like, once somebody says yes, then that's accepted. It's like,
how does a book get so different? Or how does the screenplay diverge so much from a book? Because Blade Runner is a great movie.
Yeah.
But it's so different from, what was it, Electronic Sheep?
Well,
Electronic Sheep.
Dream. Well, you've got to think about it. Like, how long does it take you to read a book?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
So you have to distill it.
You have to distill it. Like, a movie's, what, 2 hours? You know what I mean? Like, so, like, for example, like...
A ton of Clockwork Orange is in the movie, though. Yeah. Same with Jesse James.
I think, like, the best adaptations are able to fit in as much as possible, like, into it, that, like, at least feels like the book. You know what I mean? Like, you're not ever going to get, unless you do, like, an 8-hour epic miniseries,
right.
you know, you're not going to be able to distill a fucking 700, 800-page novel, you know, into, like, 2 hours, or, you know, whatever even 3 hours is pushing it.
Sometimes I think the movie is better than the book. I think there was something Burroughs said. He said a decent book will make a good movie, but a good book will only make a decent movie. So
yeah.
I think Jaws by Peter Benchley wasn't that great. Mario Puzo's mm-hmm. Godfather wasn't that great.
But as a film, it was like a masterpiece.
And then
the
inverse is true. They've tried. I haven't seen the latest Gatsby, but they've tried to film Vonnegut and Fitzgerald, and it doesn't come off.
I think there's a lot of truth in that. Like, I think that, like, you can only adapt, like, even like when they remake and do reboots of shit, like, right. I think the best reboots are movies that are flawed. Like, when they remake a movie that, like, everyone's accepted, it's like, oh, that really wasn't a good movie.
Right.
Then they reboot it and it becomes a great film. It's like, those, like, the concept is there.
Right.
So it's still rich to be, like, exploited. But when it's already good and you remake it, all you're doing is comparing. Everyone's comparing. Like
Gus Van Sant's Psycho
to, like, the original Psycho. Yeah, it's like you already have something that people already look at as, like, a beloved. Some people view it as a classic already. It's already, you know, and then you try to remake it, you're already fighting an uphill battle.
I haven't seen the new Dawn of the Dead. I heard it was good, and even when I see little pieces of it, it looks good, but I just won't watch it just because I'm married to that original.
Yeah, well, I love the original Dawn of the Dead, and I love the remake.
And the remake is
not the same movie.
Right.
Like, it's just the same in title. And that's how you have to look at it, honestly, because, like, that, like, I was on board like that. I was like, well, so Dawn of the Dead is a classic, you know.
Right.
Blah, blah. But, like, when you watch the movie, you realize, like, oh, the only thing that about this is that it's in a mall. Like, everything else is, like, different. I mean, yeah, it involves zombies, but the characters are different. The situations are different.
The pace looked a lot different.
Yeah, the zombies are fast, which made a lot of, like, diehard fans
pissed
off. I mean,
even the movie, the original was, like, Scarface. I mean, it's just a big
movie.
Right,
yeah. But then again, it depends on who's, like, it was people hate Zack Snyder now, but it was Zack Snyder directing it.
He wrote the Scooby-Doo movie.
No, James Gunn wrote it. James Gunn's the guy who he directed Guardians of the Galaxy, Slither.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. James Gunn, good writer, like, a good director.
Yeah.
And then the Zack Snyder, who did the Batman vs Superman movie, who, you know, everybody hates Zack Snyder now. But here's the thing, though. Like, I don't fucking hate Zack Snyder. Like, I watch Zack Snyder movies, and I'm like, this guy has chops. Like, he's not, like, people want to make him out to be, like, this dumb, like, Michael Bay-esque type director. And he's right. Like, he's not. Like, yeah, true. Like, he can't write. Like, he does things that are, like, you can tell it's, like, a director taking over and trying to meld the story and force elements in. Yeah. Like, you get that. But, like, he's competent. Like, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, shit doesn't work sometimes. You know what I mean? Like, all those superhero movies he's done, you can pick them apart. And that movie Sucker Punch, which he wrote, was terrible. Like, you know, it was shitty.
There are some uneven directors I like. I like Joel Schumacher. He's made some bad movies and some good movies. Yeah, that was really bad.
Yeah. I just think that, like, he right now it's cool to shit on him. Like, that's the thing now. Like, so anything that comes out with Zack Snyder, like, it's already going to be shitty.
I don't judge Journeyman. What I don't like is when somebody does what David Cross did, where they take the money, they do a film, and then they badmouth it, like the Chipmunks thing.
Yeah.
Trying to rationalize it, saying, well, you know, I wanted a house. That's fine, but I mean, I have a couple of books that I don't think are that good. Right. I'm not going to badmouth them because...
Like, I think if you take the check, you just need to shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I really do. I think that, like, it's like, yeah, let the work speak for itself. Don't shit on it. You know what I mean? Like,
I love Mr. Show, though. That is my favorite show of all time.
Like, I'm definitely one of those people who's definitely, like, you know, like, I realize that, like, hey, I might be. I've written some shit for money that, like, if it ever got made, I know for a fact, like, it's gonna be shitty. Like,
I think you told me about the cherub, the killer cherub.
Yeah, the Cupid thing. Yeah. Like, I know that if that thing got made, which is not probably not gonna get made, they pay me, like, barely any money. And, like, but if it got made, it was probably gonna be terrible. You know what I mean? But,
I'm glad I didn't have success early. You know, when I was 17 or 18, I probably thought I was really good. There was a kid, Nick McDonald. His father is pretty big in publishing. He wrote this book, 12. They turned it into a movie with 50 Cent by Joel Schumacher.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
The book was really bad, but he was the son of somebody really famous, and or powerful at least, and they got blurbs by Joan Didion, Richard Price, Hunter Thompson, and I was so fucking jealous of him. And now I look back and I say, thank God I didn't have any connections. Yeah. Thank God I had to practice for about a decade before anything saw the light of day, because if I had gotten something published when I thought I was good enough...
Right.
If I wasn't, I'd be really embarrassed. I'm embarrassed by some of what I did, but not to that extent if I'd had success early.
I honestly, this is another thing, too, that, like the shit that we look at, like, that we look at is, like, oh, it's this great piece of work. Like, the person who wrote it is always the fucking, more 9 times out of 10, I'm telling you, probably, like, as much as people say Harper Lee, like, wrote that Kill a Mockingbird, she was done, like, I guarantee, like, on some levels, there's times where she thinks that book's a piece of shit.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Well, like, Robert Benton, I was talking with Scott Phillips. One of my favorite movies is Bad Company with Jeff Bridges and Barry Brown. I'm not sure if you've seen it. It has both Lebowskis and it has David Huddleston. And he said, Phillips said, Benton does not like that movie. I said, that movie's fucking great. I mean, I think later he made, like, Ordinary People. He said, yeah, but it was his first movie, so when he watches it, all he sees is his mistakes.
Yeah, all you see is the flaws. Yeah.
But it's not my movie, so I enjoy it.
I think that, like, any kind of, like, creative endeavor, like, I think that from being the person who built it from the ground up, that's all you're going to fucking see. And, like, I distrust people who are satisfied with their work. You know what I mean?
Well, I've edited it so much that when I read it, I've memorized it, so I can't surprise
myself. Like, I can have a good idea if I did something that's good. I can be like, hey, I'm proud of that. But I know for a fact, like, having the inside view, like, even if people hailed it and said it was great, like, I'm my own worst critic, and I believe, like, the best, you know, the best artist, if you want to say sound pretentious, the best artist, they're the same way, where it's like, yeah, okay, but, like, I know how the fucking, you know, I know how the sausage is made.
Right.
So, you know,
in boxing, they say no fighter is ever 100%.
Right.
If you ever were 100% satisfied with your performance, maybe you wouldn't do it again.
Yeah.
Maybe if you had that Scarlet Letter, Great
Gatsby. So maybe I'm wrong about Harper Lee. Maybe she just said, fuck it, I stuck the swan dive and I'm done. You know what I mean?
Like, she wrote a couple articles after that. I've heard the rumor is, I don't know if it's any substance to it, that supposedly Truman Capote ghost wrote it for her. She was with him when he wrote In Cold Blood, and they were really close.
I never knew that, for real?
Well, it's a rumor. But yeah, I mean, that could explain her silence. That maybe she doesn't want to be caught out. I heard that the ghost set of Watchmen was bad.
Yeah, but I heard that, like, basically, like, they just did that. She's, how old is she now? In her
80s? They were taking advantage.
They just took advantage of her. Like, I don't think it's like, if Harper Lee was, you know, even in her 60s, she would have let that shit go. I mean, obviously she didn't all the way up to this point.
But I mean, it's Salinger. Why did he maintain silence? I think he just wanted to work in peace. I don't think he wanted to. Acclaim, but he could have been scared.
There is something, like, mad romantic about, like, the one, like, I made this one fucking great boom, I'm done. Like, yeah. That walking away from the table clean, like, I won. It's like going to a casino and hitting the jackpot, yeah. And then just leaving, like, fuck.
It's graceful. It's better than, you know, what you have to see a lot when we're talking about boxing, the guy who just keeps going back.
Going back over and over again to the point where you're like, oh, no. Like,
but if it's what you do, I mean, you can't control it. And some people do have good resurgences. I think Stephen King's comeback initially was ill-advised, but I think he's done really good. I think he's as good as he ever was.
But I think that, like, also, like, that's that balance of, like, yo, like, I don't, me personally, like, I want to see people continue to create. Like, I don't want to see people, you know what I mean? Like, especially if they've done something that I think is, like, brilliant. Or, right. like, I want to continue to read, you know, more of their shit. Like, it's as cool as it is that, like, they made that one thing and left, or they made whatever and they stepped away.
Right.
Like, if they're still around and they're able to generate more shit, like, I would... You know, I always...
One of the critiques I hear is that there's a pattern. Mm. So people say, a formula. They say, I read a book by Chuck Palahniuk. This is not me, just what people say. I read a book by Chuck Palahniuk, and after you read one, it's like there's a formula, and you've read them all. So maybe writers are scared that there's going to be a pattern detected. Like when a boxer keeps doing the same thing, he eventually gets timed and knocked out.
But, like, at the end of the day, that becomes that art and commerce thing, too, which is something like... It's like, at the end of the day, you got to... You know, like, you got to pay your bills. You know, Palahniuk's got to continue to write these fucking novels. You know, he's going to stop because people are...
Well, some guys can stop because I think Jean Genet and Salinger had something similar where the publisher said, we like this book so much and we know you're going to do more. We'll give you $6,000 a month for the rest of your life regardless of whether or not you write because we know you're going to write more books. The guy says, sure. And he says, I'm done.
Yeah.
Give me my six every month. And because these things are picked up by high schools like To Kill a Mockingbird,
right.
You can sit on royalties from one book for the rest of your life. S.E. Hinton... didn't have to do anything after The Outsider. She wrote after that, but she didn't have to. I mean, I don't have her tax returns, but I'm pretty sure you're set if you're in the grade schools or high schools.
That would be awesome, honestly, to just have that option to be like, you know.
I fantasize about it.
Yeah, you know what I mean? But I think that, like, the urge to create would still be there, you know what I mean? Especially with all that fucking idle time.
Well, they said Salinger throws it in a safe like Prince. He does all these videos and albums. Yeah, vault, basically. I would do that. I would become, like, some crazy Howard Hughes-y recluse and just keep working, but slowly
pissing in jars and...
Shoot Kleenex boxes on the toes. I'm already nuts, and I only have a small house, so it's probably good that I'm not rich off my books because it could get really bad.
Yeah, I don't know, like, I debate, you know what I mean? Like, I know, like you were saying, like, having that background of, like, working in factories and shit.
Right.
Like, dude, like, I just, all I can do is this shit. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't invest in anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, for me personally, making money off of this is important to me. Like, you know what I mean? So it's like, finding that, like, middle ground, like, it's like, dude, at the end of the day, like, I want to be able to support myself. I don't want to fucking continue to, you know, work at a fucking, you know, even whether it's a warehouse or a fucking cubicle,
right,
and deal with the fucking, the mundane, everyday fucking punching the clock, dealing with the politics of an office or a warehouse. Like, that shit is, like, it informs a lot of, like, my experience in terms of, like, life and dealing with fucking people, but, like, dude, like, that, to me, is, like, fuck that. I want to live, like, an artist life. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
but you got to fight a bunch of other people who have the same idea.
You have to, exactly.
And you're not in direct head-to-head competition. But what's Jim Norton said, you know, I've never had a backup plan B, never went to college, never got another job because I wanted to force myself to either make enough to live with comedy or just die. So, I mean, I guess in some situations you don't want a plan B because if you have it, you'll go to your plan B.
Yeah, exactly. Me personally, like, that's one of the things that I'm just, like, I'm not a person who, like, I'm be honest, like, I don't fucking take orders well.
Right.
That's why I couldn't be in the military. You know what I mean? I guess I could.
Right.
My brother's in the military, but, like, I guess if I had to, given the situation, but, like, I just...
If I can do it, anybody can do it.
Yeah, I just don't want to. You know what I mean? Like, I don't, as terms, forget the military in life. Like, I just don't take orders well, period. Like, I just fucking don't, like, I'm the kid that doesn't play well with others or whatever.
I think I could be a mortician. I mean, it's like a two-year thingy.
Yeah.
Your clients are not mouthy.
Yeah, they're already, yeah.
But if I had to choose, delivering pizzas was not that bad because you could drive and listen to music for most of your shift was not spent with your employer or with your customers. It was spent en route between the two, which let me listen to music, so.
Yeah, yeah. What is speaking of music, what type of music do you like? What type of shit do you listen to music while you write?
Non-lyrical when I'm working, you know, echoes, ambient music, classical music. Outside of that, there's nobody more eclectic. I like heavy metal, rap, country, blues, classical music, alternative, folk. I'll listen to every and anything. I know a lot of people say I'll listen to everything except rap and country or heavy metal and country. I'll listen to metal and country as well. I listen to everything. That's another way I don't fit anywhere in society.
Yeah, I tend to use music as a way to, like, I definitely use it when I write, but I tend to use it as a way to, like, get my, like, the background, like my mind starts to work.
Sure.
Like, with fucking noise around, you know what I mean? Like, and not necessarily people, because, like, I find myself, I can write in a coffee shop, but, like, I find myself paying attention to, like, people.
I couldn't do it in public, it'd feel like.
Yeah, like I found, like, so music is a far better solution, like, to just stick the fucking earbuds in and just, like, have it blaring in the, and, like, for whatever reason, like, the more aggressive the music is, like, it's, like, that's what I need to, like, propel me forward.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I like aggressive shit. Like, if I'm listening to something that's really relaxed, really mellow, like, I tend to, like, not work. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know what that says about me, but, you know what I mean?
A lot of electronic stuff, just stuff that's sort of concentration helping music. Like, I can listen to Tangerine Dream, but then I can listen to Beethoven and Bach, too. Just anything where the person is really in the zone, you know, in the pocket, in their own zone.
Yeah.
Just kind of gets you there.
Yeah, yeah. Do you fucking... I know you said you don't, like, watch a lot of TV.
Mm-hmm.
Do you keep up with, like, any of the fucking, like, what's going on in the world in terms of, like, politics?
Yeah,
in
yeah.
Terms
of, I read a weird cross-section of far-right to far-left stuff. I try to keep an open mind. I read Counterpunch and The Intercept, which are left-wing magazines. And, let's see, I read a couple of aggregators. I have OCD bad, so I have 10 news sites, and I will bounce back and forth between all of them. My favorite blogger is a guy named Robert Lindsay. He's a member of the Communist Party in California, and he's also a Bigfoot enthusiast. He tracks down Bigfoot. But I don't agree with him about anything, but he's really un-PC, far-left guy. And I mean, he's just brilliant and weird.
Far-left or far-right?
He's far-left.
Far-left? The craziest people believe in Bigfoot, by the way. Like, you know you're a fucking crazy motherfucker when you believe in Bigfoot.
Yeah, he could just be into cryptozoology just for the fun. I mean, he could be lying to himself. But I think it's called... it's at robertlindsay.wordpress.com, above top secret. He's nuts, but he's very intelligent.
I think... What do you think about the fucking... this, like, new, like, alt-right...
Yeah, I heard...
it's fucking weird, man.
Yeah, I heard Hillary's speech, and I think she said Putin was at the head of it. So, I mean, it's mostly young
like,
kids.
Yeah.
I think Milo's saying they're trying to just get a rise out of people.
Yeah.
Which is probably true, so it's probably best that, you know, people running for election should ignore them.
Yeah, so, but I mean, I just find it weird. It's like this fucking, like, weird, creepy...
the frog?
Creepy, like, white nationalist...
Yeah.
Like,
it's just based around a frog, right? Pepe?
Pepe, yeah.
I don't know what he is. I used to go to 4chan sometimes and see that frog, but I don't know what exactly.
Like, I don't understand. Like, honestly, truthfully, like, I hear, like, when they say shit, like, they call people cuck. Mm-hmm. I guess it's short for, like, cuckold. Like, that shit doesn't mean anything to me. Like, it's like its own language. It's like its own...
oh, yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
I think it goes back to the cuckoo bird. It lands in another bird's nest, I think, and it forces it to raise its young, so... They might be talking about pornography.
Yeah, and they call everybody cucks, and it's just like this weird, like...
I haven't had enough sex to get into cuckold pornography. I don't want somebody to fuck my girlfriend. I need a girlfriend
first. I actually worked...
Yeah.
Before I moved to L.A., I worked in I won't say the name of the place because I worked at a place and one of the lead was a woman and she and her husband were like, they were into that shit.
Yeah.
Like, they would go to swing clubs and, like, she would invite dudes over and, like, watch.
I don't judge it, but I mean, I don't either,
but it's just so fucking weird. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's
gratification, like, from not being gratified is weird. Also, I have too much physical pain. When I look at, like, BDSM and stuff, I'm like, shit, that must hurt. I'd need ice for, like, 2 hours in Advil.
Yeah, people are into some weird fucking shit, dude. Like, you know, to each their own, you know what I mean? I'm not trying to judge, but, like, it's just fucking weird. And typically, like, everybody that I've seen...
Mm-hmm.
that is like into like the swinger shit is like people middle-aged. That people you don't want to you know, people you don't want to see fucking to begin with.
Cesarean scar.
Yeah, yeah, it's like it's like, you know, yeah, so it's just kind of like that whole fucking vibe. Like, just even I've never even just talking to her like scared me away from like that scene altogether.
Yeah, I was like a teenager, I mean, I think everybody did. I looked a lot of porn. I haven't looked at it in years. I don't consider myself puritanical.
Yeah,
it's just like.
I think like fucking we're desensitized.
I want my imagination back. Yeah.
I think we're desensitized, yeah. Dude. Like, especially now. Like, remember like when we were younger, like finding porn was like a...
Or even very softcore stuff on like, yeah, Showtime would get you.
Right, but like finding porn, like actual porn, was like a fucking...
A physical copy.
Yeah, like if you found that porn, like everybody finds that fucking magazine that, yeah, in the fucking woods or some shit. You know, like that was a thing. That was like a hallmark or a moment in your fucking like your
coming of age.
Like, yeah, everyone found that porn.
That hustler. That,
but like, I can't even imagine like being a kid now. It's like the access to it, it's like everything that you can fucking think of exists at literally at your fingertips.
There's a quote, Marshall McLuhan, "The medium is the message." Yeah. The problem with internet pornography might not necessarily be the pornography; it might be the internet, because it's rerouting our brains, and so it creates sort of a like a Skinner box effect. It's changing the myelin sheaths around people's brains. There's a book by Larry Rosen called Eye Disorder. It's inducing schizophrenia-like conditions in people. I'm too old to understand, yeah, the cyberbullying and things like that.
Yeah. But, see, that's a foreign concept to us because, yeah, we grew up in a time when there was no fucking internet. So,
well,
like...
I grew up with... We might be a little different in ages. I grew up with internet maybe 12 to 16, maybe 15, 16. I would look at pornography and stuff, but I it was bad for me. I mean, I'm not conservative.
But, like, it was there, but it wasn't, like... You know what I mean? Like, when it... I remember it coming, like... We had... I think I want to say it was a kindergarten or first grade where we started to have computer class.
Right.
You know what I mean? And then, like, by the time I got into high school, the internet was a thing.
Right.
But it wasn't like it is now. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you had to dial up and the fucking... You know,
oh,
what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. You had to wait.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the kids who've... I was reading about the Columbine kids and... What's his name? Klebold was really big into fetish sex. It's one thing if you're in your 20s and maybe you're trying to spice things up, but if you've never, like, kissed a girl or held a girl's hand,
yeah,
like, BDSM is probably, you know, sadomasochism is probably not good if you've never held a girl's hand or something. It's maybe...
I think I'm wondering, like, the effects of, like, 50 Shades of Grey on, like, all these fucking, like, girls and, like, because I know a lot of, like, not only were, like, a lot of women reading that book, but I'd seen, like, a lot of younger chicks reading that book. Like, that book did well. I mean, it was a...
The men's rights guys would tell you that the reason the guy gets away with all the rape is because he's super rich and attractive. Well, I think it's borderline rape, is because he's super rich and attractive. So the message is you can get away with whatever you want if you're super rich and attractive. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Like, maybe that's true. I don't know.
That sounds about
I'm not
right.
Super rich or attractive. So and I'm also not a borderline rapist.
But I'm just like wondering, like, how that's going to affect, you know, like, I'm wondering, like I said, like, I can only imagine.
If it's fantasy and it's being kept in the pure realm of fantasy, okay, they'll probably be okay. But I've heard, I never bash something without reading it myself. So I don't know whether or not Twilight is as shitty as everybody says. I don't know if 50 Shades is shit.
Yeah.
They might be. I don't know.
I'm gonna go on a limb and say what I've read of it is fucking terrible.
I've heard enough to keep me away.
Yeah. So yeah, it's not fucking like. I didn't read the whole thing, but what I've read of it, when I've attempted to, like, because out of curiosity, it was like, yeah, dude, I couldn't even do it. Like, it was just like.
Yeah, but bashing, like, Twilight is like bashing Bieber. It's like four or 14-year-old girls.
Yeah,
I'm not a 14-year-old girl.
Right. And I honestly, truthfully, I think that, like, the Twilight shit is a less. I can deal with that more than the 50 Shades of Grey shit, because, like, the 50 Shades of Grey shit started out as, like, fanfic from Twilight.
My brother told me that.
Yeah, like, and that's just so weird. You know what I mean? Like, and then, like, you see E.L. James, who I'm pretty sure she's a nice fucking woman, but, like, you see how much, like, control and power she's gotten since, like, since the success of that book.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even, like, with the movie, like, behind the scenes, it's like she controls fucking everything. She controls everything to the point that, like, the sequel is being written by her husband.
How did the movie do? Like,
the movie did well. I mean, it did.
It,
I mean, it
made though.
It critically, of course. Yeah. Everything's gonna get panned, but you know, but, like, they're making another one. And, like I said, this is how much juice that she has, is that her husband, who's not a writer of note whatsoever,
right,
is hired to write the sequel.
What is it? 50 Shades of Greyer?
One of those darker 50 Shades, something. Okay. I don't fucking know. Yeah, but you know what I mean? Like, I just, like, I've heard stories from people kind of, like, on the inside of, like, how much, like,
Women I know say it's pretty, who are into erotica, say it's vanilla for them. Like, if it's for a casual person who doesn't know much about erotica, it's fine. For somebody who's deep into it, it's like very tame.
Yeah, I know it has fisting in it, so I think that's kind of extreme.
Probably not, sadly, at this point. That's first base.
Yeah,
that's
really first base. Yeah. We're living in a new era. Yeah. I keep forgetting that. I'm kind of out of touch. I don't know, man. Like, fuck, what? I know you like boxing. What's your obsession with boxing? I mean, I've loved boxing since I was a kid.
Yeah, but God damn. I don't know. I mean, it's like when I throw my ball for my dog, why does she chase it kind of thing. It's like too deeply ingrained for me to really understand it. It's like your motor neurons get invested in the action. There's a lot. I mean, if you look at which sports have brought forth the best writing, boxing is far and away. There's a lot of, not to wax too Norman Mailer, but there's a lot of pathos in it. There's a lot of emotion in it. And the skill required to do it really well is just insane. Yeah. Like when you look at guys like Mayweather or Lomachenko types, the hit and not get hit. And the books about it, the nonfiction like Thomas Hauser, or the fiction like Fat City, I mean, it's just insane. So, I mean, it's just a great sport that's made a lot of great art.
Are you going to write a boxing novel?
I probably shouldn't, because, I mean, there are too many people who got in the ring before me. That's what Tarantino, they asked him why he didn't have boxing in Pulp Fiction, why he skipped it. And he said, I'm not getting in the ring after Scorsese. There's a book by W.C. Hines, a professional, that's really good. There's just too much good boxing fiction for me to open my mouth.
I think it's going to happen.
Written some nonfiction about it.
Yeah, but I think it's going to happen, dude, because I just think it's too much. Like, you read a lot of fucking nonfiction boxing. I think at some point, you're like...
What story could you do? I guess you can do a story that's been done and do it better, but what story could you do that hasn't been done? There's the Down and Outer, there's the Rocky... You know, the Cinderella Man. I mean, what narrative is left to
the journey? To plumb? Like you said, maybe it's the fucking loser, the absolute.
The journey. Well, the Fat City is kind of like that, but journeymen are interesting. You know, these guys who have the talent to win and they're told basically to lose or something.
Yeah, the guys
pointing about
the guys who have the fucking 45 losses. Those guys.
Reggie Strickland has the worst record in history. He's from Cincinnati, something like 39 and 250 losses.
See, that's a story. Like you were saying, like we were talking about that briefly. Mm-hmm. Like that's definitely like some shit. Like I would, like I guess it would be like hell of. I guess it would be kind of like hard to watch.
There's a true story about two journeyman brothers who both committed suicide when they had the same record.
Yeah.
That's Shakespearean, but I mean, I don't know if people are going to pay to watch two brothers commit suicide.
Yeah, it's fucking depressing as hell. Like, I could just see that, like, do both of them get the shit beat out of them? Like,
Creed was very good. That surprised me. I didn't think there was anything left in the Rocky series, even with New Blood.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a very good movie. Andre Ward was in it, too.
Yeah, I liked Creed a lot. Actually, Creed was one of my favorite movies of that year. But I would, like I said, I like Ryan Coogler. Mm-hmm. I think they just made their good choice. They actually did somebody who's like a fucking filmmaker. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that dude takes film seriously. Like,
it was plausible enough. Yeah. I mean, I was glad he lost against that guy.
I like the small. That movie was great because of like the details. Like, not
the
only
deaf
the
girl.
Yeah, not only the details with like the boxing and like him incorporating like, you know, shit like incorporating the 24/7 shit, incorporating like some real fighters,
right.
Incorporating like kind of like the day to day come up.
Who's the English fighter he fought at the end? Guy has a really thick accent. He's a pro in real life.
Yeah, what is his name?
I don't know. I know Ward was in it.
Yeah, SOG was in it. But I'm trying to. I forget the name of that fighter too. But like the fighting shit was good. But also like the things like they said it in Philly,
right?
And like they had like a lot of Phillyisms in it. Like a lot of this shit. Like I noticed. Like oh, like not only did they had the Philly. You ever seen 12 o'clock? 12 o'clock boys.
Uh-uh. Is that the motorcycle?
The motorcycle. Yeah, like they incorporated that shit. Like because Philly has a bike culture like that too. I think 12 o'clock boys might have been Baltimore though.
Right.
But there's a lot of like a lot of the street bike culture. And then there's like just the little things like the Philly slang, and like there's just like a lot of attention to detail of like that area.
The subplot with the girlfriend was not corny, which surprised me.
Yeah.
It was not bad.
But Coogler's one of those guys who like
he did Fruitvale Station.
Yeah, Fruitvale Station. He comes from like he's from the Bay. You know, he's from like Oakland, and. Like, that's one of the things that, like, you could tell it's important to him as a filmmaker, those details, like...
It doesn't feel like, I think when Above the Rim came out, Marlon Wayans and Tupac were laughing about their character's name, saying it was like built by a committee of old white guys. It doesn't feel like it's a committee of old guys who are just trying to figure out what the quote-unquote hood experience is or whatever. It feels authentic.
I think that's what it is. Like, and I think that's a problem with like a lot of movies. Honestly, they are built by a fucking committee. They are built by old white dudes or creative executives who are just.
It's fine if you're writing about an old white dude, but if you're writing about a young black guy.
But like,
although Richard Price did a pretty convincing job of writing from a young black guy's perspective.
Well, Richard Price is like, I think writes some of the most realistic dialogue because like he's like a dude who like he's totally the guy who's walking around like listening in on everyone's conversation.
Yeah, he said they thought he was an undercover cop because he was with those the clockers for about 5 years. Just
heard of Will Beall?
Uh-oh.
Will Beall was a former LAPD. I think for a long time he still worked in the LAPD, but I think he's retired. He was a cop in the gang unit in LA. He literally moved from like the Midwest somewhere to be a cop in LA, like because he wanted to go where the action was.
Right.
He wrote this book called LA Rex, and like it is, you can like literally tell like he was writing down the shit that he heard while he was on the gang unit beat. Like, like
you got to read Inside then, that book I gave you, because of the dialogue is insane.
The dialogue is great, but one of his favorites is Richard Price in terms of like his one of his favorite writers.
Yeah, he's the
but
best.
But he transferred over because like LA Rex is a good novel, but then he wrote the script for it. It was a good script, but then he started doing screenplays exclusively. Like he wrote what's the movie with Ryan Gosling, the fucking gangster movie? Mickey Cohen.
Gangster Squad.
Gangster Squad.
Police Cops.
His script for Gangster Squad was cool.
Yeah.
The movie was not so much. Fleischer kind of like, he did Zombieland, which was cool, but like, he fucking, that movie came off hella cheesy. Kinda, but Beall wrote that. I think Beall was hired to write the Justice League. Like, now he's a fucking screenwriter.
Right.
But like, his shit was really, like, you could tell it was like, oh yeah, this dude just mind like literally all this shit about like LA gang culture and LA, you know what I'm saying, like the stories that he told was like
you might like New Jack. Have you heard of it by Ted Conover? He went to a Sing Sing. He's a reporter. He said, what's it like to be a guard in Sing Sing? So he became a guard. He said, what's it like to be a coyote smuggling people across the border? So he did it. So it sounds like did the guy become a cop to write about being a cop?
He said he didn't. He said that, like, he said he always liked writing, but he said that, like, he was conscious of, like, I'm if I'm a cop, I'm going to be a cop.
Right.
Like, I'll write. And he said he would write shit down, but he was like, I'm going to be a cop. And he even, like, even after he sold his few scripts and sold his book, he was still a cop for a long time. I just think that he reached the point where he's no longer, I believe he's no longer a cop still.
That was what Williford talked about with, he said, there's soldier writers and writer soldiers.
Yeah.
Soldier writer is James Jones, wrote The Thin Red Line.
Yeah.
Spent 20 years. Or not 20, but a long time in, was a soldier, then wrote.
Right.
Then there's Oliver Stone, the writer soldier, the guy who's scared as shit and says, all right, if I don't die, I'm going to write the great American novel.
He's definitely, I think he's definitely, he would be the soldier writer.
The cop writer.
The cop writer.
Writer
this,
cop. Joseph Wambaugh.
Wambaugh. Yeah, exactly. With his all his books, like Centurions and all the Hollywood novels, the Hollywood whatever. I tried to read some Wambaugh.
I think The Onion Field, it was either Onion Field or Cujo was the first book I read, like adult book.
That was the first adult book you read?
I think in the third grade I read.
I think everybody, I think King is like everyone, like most people, like in like our kind of like age bracket, like I think and under, like I think King is like the gateway. Like
we thought he was just like an old dude who lived in a castle because everything that was horror said Stephen King, like the movies.
I remember reading King way too early, too. Like, I remember...
I saw It when I was too young, and I was really paralyzed by that.
Yeah, it'll fuck you up. Like, it is, like, the worst. Like, especially it gives you the fixation with clowns are creepy as fuck anyways. But to have exposure, like, at a young age to that, that's fucked up. Yeah, King... I'm trying to think of I'm pretty sure King was the first adult book I read.
Do you remember which one?
I want to say Pet Sematary.
Yeah, that's one his wife won't read because it was about the death of a little boy who was about their son's age.
Yeah, I think it was Pet Sematary.
That's I love that book. Movies, not that good. King translates hit and miss, I think.
Yeah, he's definitely had more more misses. I mean, Carrie was awesome. The Shining, I know you don't like The Shining, but he doesn't even like the fucking Shining.
Yeah, he said it's like a beautiful car with no interior.
Yeah, but I like The Shining. It's one of those movies that I can rewatch and see different shit over and over again. Have you ever seen Room Room 237, I think.
No, the one with Johnny Depp or whatever.
No, Room 127.
No.
It's a documentary about The Shining.
Oh, yeah, I've heard about that.
When, like, it's just all these conspiracy theories that people have.
Oh, right.
Like, The Shining is about Kubrick faking the moon landing, or The Shining is about... they're pointing out, like, these people have these crazy fucking, like, tinfoil hat theories about what The Shining... It's great, because you just listen to, like, all these weird...
Right.
Theories like the fucking moon one is great. Like,
I heard that about 2001 too. That people said HAL was IBM and all this other.
Yeah. Well, that room, that there's a whole documentary, and it's literally just people talking.
That was at the Esquire here.
Yeah. But room 13. That's the one with John Cusack and Samuel L. Jackson. That was.
Oh yeah.
I think it was. Like, was the it room 13?
Secret Window wasn't too bad.
Secret Window wasn't too bad. Johnny Depp.
I think King loved The Dead Zone, and I think that one was really good with
David Cronenberg.
The ice is gonna break, Christopher Walken.
Dead Zone's great. Yeah. Fuck, I'm trying to think what else. Fucking Maximum Overdrive was shitty.
Yeah, he directed that. Yeah. Firestarter was crap.
You know what the funniest thing is? Have you ever seen, like, there's like a trailer or like a promotional commercial for Maximum Overdrive, and it's like Stephen King, and it's like, if you want something done right, you have to do it yourself. Like I'm doing this, like, a film by Stephen King, like, Maximum Overdrive. That is the funniest shit in hindsight. Like,
it's not Emilio's worst hour. I think he did, like, 8 of those Mighty Ducks movies.
Yeah, isn't it, like, Emilio, like, all Christian-y now?
I don't know. I mean, I think he's just directing now.
He's directing, but isn't he, like, didn't he, like, have to, like, I mean, obviously, you don't want to go Charlie route.
It's what
AIDS and
what's his name, you know? Patrice O'Neill said, "Fuck Tiger Blood. That guy's selling his own blood." I love Young Guns when I was a kid, though.
Yeah, Young Guns. Oh, dude, like Young Guns. Probably I've probably watched that 500 times. Yeah. Both the first one and the sequel as a kid. Like
the sequel is weird because it's not bad. It's just strange, and it something doesn't click, but it's not bad.
I don't know how many. That's one of those movies that, like, I know I've seen so many times. I can't tell you how many times I've seen it. Yeah.
It's got Terrence Stamp, Jack Palance.
Yeah, fucking Kiefer Sutherland.
Dermot Mulroney has kind of become a ladies' man. Isn't he in, like, a bunch of romantic films? Over the last 10 years?
Yeah, I think that's what his bread and butter is now. Yeah, that fucking cast is funny.
Lou Diamond
Phillips.
Last time I saw him was in that Larry Clark movie, Another Day in Paradise.
Larry Clark is a fucking... pedophile.
Yeah, I liked Bully though.
Bully's cool.
Yeah, I thought it was believable.
I like Kids. Honestly, I like Kids. Kids was probably too real. Like, even watching it now, like, but you understand, like, this is how much our culture has changed though. Like, if you watch Kids now, like back when we watched it, when Casper fucked the girl at the very end.
Oh, when she was unconscious.
What did you think? We were like, oh, he's got AIDS. But now looking at it, you're like, oh, he's a fucking rapist.
Yeah.
Like, well, we didn't even think about that, like, back then. We just thought,
in love with her, though. What's Chloe Sevigny?
Did you watch The Brown Bunny?
Yeah.
Where she fucking sucks off. She fucking sucks off Gallo on camera.
Yep. Rosario Dawson was beautiful in that too. When I was a kid, I was obsessed with both.
Well, they were like, Larry Clark literally, like, lured them with candy off the street.
Yeah, he saw Harmony Korine skateboarding or something. It's sad to go back and watch it because what's his name, Justin Pierce, committed suicide.
Yeah. I think that movie is such a realistic portrait of, like, teens in general, but teens there at that time in New York City.
Yeah, my sister was going to Tisch in the 90s, and I remember visiting her there and seeing George Washington Park and all that, where they filmed it.
Oh, your sister went to NYU?
Yeah.
What'd she study? She's
acting. She also went to RADA, the Royal Academy.
Is that your sister? Was that the reading?
No, that was my sister-in-law, my real birth sister. Yeah. Like everyone else in my family, I've alienated her, so I can't even talk to her.
So if she went to Tisch in the 90s, then she's older than, so.
Oh, yeah. She told me she worked the door at a club, maybe Gatian's The Tunnel or something like that, where the Wu-Tang went, and she got fired because she turned Derek Jeter away because she didn't know anything about sports.
The Tunnel, that was a fucking notorious club in New York.
They got rid of it, didn't they?
Yeah.
Gatian was like a big drug dealer guy or something.
Yeah, The Tunnel was, like, known for, like, obviously, like, violence and
shit. Wu-Tang.
Yeah, like, all the rap groups would go perform at The Tunnel, but they would come with, like, hella crewed up, the posses, people armed, people get stabbed shot. Yeah, people got banned all the time.
It was also where Vin Diesel used to be a bouncer there. Remember the Michael Alec, the killer? Remember the party monster? They made him.
Oh, yeah, the one with Macaulay Culkin? Yeah. The Tunnel's, that's like one of those notorious.
The Limelight was another Gatian club, I remember. Yeah, I mean, I stayed with her a little while in New York. When you talk about L.A. or New York, I get scared. I just feel like I can't compete. Like, I can do what I do, but only in my little Midwestern hovel. If you put me in a big city, I'll get crushed.
I had to, like, honestly, L.A. was, like, I felt, I loved L.A., but I could totally understand, like, how people could see it as, like me personally, I was never intimidated by L.A.
I want money when I'm out there. Like, when I'm in New York or L.A., it's like, I really need to get a lot of money because there's a lot of life.
Yeah.
In Cincinnati, you're not, I mean, what are you going to do, buy a hot dog or something? Yeah.
Plus, your money goes a lot far, it stretches a lot more out here. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, out there, it's like, the juxtaposition of like uber rich people to like fucking poor as fuck to like homeless is so stark, it's like so blatant, it's like, oh my god, like
that's what it seems, you know, like to Germans when they come to Cincinnati, because they have a pretty strong social safety net, you know. Maternity leave, the Greens have a pretty strong presence in the government. So my professors, when they came to America, they said, Cincinnati, I can't believe how poor some people are here.
Yeah.
How rich and how poor.
Yeah, and it's like here, you know, Cincinnati does have, like, a homeless, like, they do have homeless people, but, like, in cities like L.A., and, like, it's just, dude, it's like fucking Skid Row.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, like, you don't even have to go to Skid Row. Skid Row's just, like,
Hollywood. North Hollywood.
But Skid Row is just, like, a centralized area with a lot of homeless people, and it's like really sad, but like they're all over. Like, and
it's like they live.
Yeah, like it's like.
And then there's like a boutique eatery for dog food or something like
that.
And
like, as a struggling, like, screenwriter out there who's like having to work and like trying to get these jobs and like, oh, I get paid $5,000 for this little shitty movie, you know what I mean? Like, or whatever. Like I recognize so much how close I am to those dudes. Like, right. I'm like two mistakes away from you, dude. Like, the whole time, like, it's scary. Like, this is a scary element unless you have your shit together when you're out there.
Right.
You know, and when I moved out there, like, we had a little nest egg that wasn't as big as it should have been because we spent more than we should have. And then, like, we went through this whole entire, like, adjustment period, like, of figuring out where we're gonna fucking live. Like, and once we got settled, then like shit fell apart. So it's like that, like, you have to have your, that's one thing I know about LA is like, you have to have your shit together to be out there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I read a book about recently about pornography and the porn industry. And this guy said, I'm going to move to LA. And he had like a master's. He said, I'm going to make movies, porn, sex positive movies, change the porn industry. And like 3 weeks later, he's doing erotic massage. And like 3 months later, he was having sex with men for money for heroin.
LA is one of those places where like it'll eat you. Like you can see how it can eat people alive, because literally anything that you can think of that you want, it's there. Like, you just have to go looking for it.
Stupefied with blandishments, I guess, is how it destroyed a lot of writers. I
mean. Yeah. It's one of those things that, like, you have to be really grounded. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's probably one of the reasons why it never bothered me, like, in terms of, like, who I was. Is because, like, I moved out there and I was in my 30s. You know what I mean? Like, I've, like, went through a lot of shit. I went through a lot of shit there, but, like, I was firmly aware of, like, who I was. You know what I mean? Like, so, like, it didn't affect me. I was far more grounded having, like I said, I don't come from money, you know what I mean? Like, I don't come from, you know, privilege, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, I know friends that I grew up with who I had better than, you know what I mean? Like, in terms of, I've had both parents in the household, you know, they did okay. But, like, I know people who have, like, whose family's literally rich, you know what I mean? Like, and they literally have, like, money given to them. Like, you know what I mean? Like, oh, yeah, I have, my aunt died and she gave us all money, you know what I mean? And so I have $250,000 in the bank. Like, I know people like that. Like, that's not, like, and that's, like, you can't control, you know, what situation you're born into, you know what I mean? Like, right. And that didn't necessarily determine, like, your outcome, but, like, to me, like, that's so foreign. Like, everything that I've ever had, I had to, like, work for. Like, people didn't hand me shit. So, like, coming to LA and having that mentality of like, nobody's gonna hand me shit, I'm not entitled to shit, like anything that I get is gonna be based off merit and like hard work and like perspiration. Like, I think that's the mentality you have to survive out there. Like, if you come out there and you just have dreams, like I have dreams, but like if you come out there and on that alone with this disillusioned like idea of, you know, like it's gonna eat you alive and spit you the fuck out. Like, you know what I mean?
What's his name? Robert Towne, the guy who wrote Chinatown. He said it and everybody's looking for their peck of gold or whatever.
Right. And you have to understand, like, that, like, it's not this shit is a marathon. It's not a fucking, you know, it's not a fucking 40-yard dash. Like, you're not going to come out there and the motherfuckers are just going to shower you with fucking, you know.
Well, there are people who get lucky like that, right? Like,
yeah, but
their friend goes for the audition and they say, hey, you there.
But if you always look further into that person's story, there's always a whole entire life lived before that that built up to
like
that
De Niro
moment.
De Niro being Dustin Hoffman's waiter, and
right, like. Like fucking, like people were like Harrison Ford. Harrison Ford was a fucking, before he was an actor, he was a carpenter. A fucking years. It was
Steve Buscemi worked for a while. He hustled his ass off for a while.
Fucking look at somebody. I don't necessarily like his movies, but look at Tyler Perry. Tyler Perry, before the success, he was living in his car. Mm-hmm. Like he was fucking literally living in his fucking car, doing these like religious themed plays for, you know, black plays like. Mm-hmm. And like now he's a fucking, he has his own studio, like literally his own studio facilities in Atlanta. He's made, you know, millions of dollars, super successful. Like again, I don't like his movies particularly. They're not for me, but like that, like he didn't have, that shit didn't happen overnight. Very rarely is that overnight really an overnight. It's usually like overnight success. Oh, but it took that person 10 years or 15 years before, you know what I'm saying? Like they were striving and going towards, and things led to it. Yeah, there is some cases like where you're just born into it. You know what I mean? Like Jaden Smith. Like, okay, Jaden Smith was, his father's the biggest fucking movie star.
Is he a good actor?
I mean, I don't want to say he's bad. I mean, again, like.
I mean, I haven't watched. Like,
yeah,
the
I haven't.
Kid or something.
Yeah, I mean, like, he's not. You're not gonna look at him and say he's the second coming of fucking like I don't know.
His dad is good, but he doesn't do enough. I mean, right. 6 degrees of separation is insanely good, but then he does a lot of stupid shit.
But I think that like Jaden Smith is like one of those, like he's, him and his sister both, they're like the first, like I want to say the first black kids who are like born in a situation where they're almost white, like, you know what I mean? Like
physically,
like not even physically, like just like, you know how like a white person in like this country specifically, in around the world, like there's a sense of like you can do anything.
Oh, okay.
These kids, those two kids, were born in a world where they can literally do anything. Like,
you think they're spoiled? Would you say spoiled?
I don't know. I don't know. Like, from what I can tell, from what I know about, like, you know, from what, you know, his Will and Jada, the things that they say about how they give their kids, you know, they allow their kids to be kids, and they reinforce their, you know, them to go out into the world and they can do anything. Like, I'm sure, like, if your dad's Will Smith, you're gonna be somewhat, you know, spoiled. But like, right. I just look at that position, and look at like the fact that they're those kids. And they're born, and that, like, that's unique in terms of like them being like young black kids, like, mm-hmm. like their experience and their worldview is like some different shit. Like, it's like they're like, to them, like the limit. Like, if you hear that kid talk, right. like you're like, he says some crazy. It sounds like crazy shit. But like, how would you sound if you were fucking Will Smith's kid?
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Like,
you think they're alienated though, because it's like with Michael Jackson, it's like his he grew up poor in Gary, Indiana, but he hangs out with Liz Taylor, so it's like
yeah.
If you're black and you grew up around other black people, now you're like in some Howard Hughes-y bubble. Do you think you just
I don't know, man. I think those, like, I just think that, like, I look at them specifically, and I think that, like, that's just some different. They're like just different. Like, it's. It's almost like...
Their mom's pretty creative. She was in a metal band. She's, so she has some wildness to her.
Like, I think that, like I don't even want to say... Like, I don't even want to say... Like, I just think that, like, those kids represent, like, a new thing. Like, you know what I mean? Like...
What about Obama's older daughter? Somebody said she was at, like, Bonnaroo or something.
Bonnaroo, yeah.
Weed.
Yeah. And I'm like, let her... She's a fucking kid. You know what I mean? Like, they...
They said she's having a breakdown. It's like she's smoking weed at a...
Right. She's being a teenager. You know what I'm saying? She's going to be fine. I think she's, like, going to Harvard. Yeah. Like, she's fine. You know what I mean? Like, who doesn't experiment, you know, with the drugs and, like, when they're... You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I think most kids do at some point. Like, I think at some point in your life you will, unless you're weird like me, and, like, you don't until you're older.
I regret everything I did. I'm very square at this point.
I was a straight edge, honestly, for a long, long, long time. Because, like, I just, like I said, I one of those people who, like, I only do shit motivated by what I want to do. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm one of those motherfuckers, like, if 17 people are doing one thing, I don't want to do it. Like, you know what I mean? Like... Peer pressure to me is bullshit.
I had a horrible teen years. It was, hey, smoke this pussy or I'll punch you kind of thing.
Yeah. I think that, like, I just wouldn't, like, I don't know what it was. I just wouldn't, like, Like, I just wouldn't. And I'd be like, nah, man, I'm not doing it because you want me to do it. Like, I want to do it because I want to do it.
There's nothing wrong with weed, except that if you don't know where you're, if you don't know where you're getting it, it can be adulterated and things like
that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't even think it, like, honestly, I don't even think of weed as a drug. You know what I mean? Like, I don't. Like, I just, I've smoked it, and I just don't find it addictive. I mean, I just...
It's demotivating for me. I don't have the constitution. Some people, like Willie Nelson or Snoop Dogg, can stay high.
But it depends on what you're, it depends on what you're smoking, too.
Yeah, you know what I mean? It's like wine. It's like if you have good stuff, you don't have...
Like, that's why when I did smoke a lot more in L.A., like, it was always sativa instead of, like, indica, because, like, the sativa shit would, like... In theory, it gives you energy. You know what I mean? Like, as opposed to indica makes you tired.
It's pretty much legal there, isn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't it
legal? Yeah, it's like, I lived in the street I lived on. I lived in a place called Tahunga. Mm-hmm. And, like, there's a foothill. It's a foothill road. Like, there was, like, eight. I want to say, like, eight just right up the street. Eight different dispensaries. Like, they're all over L.A.
Those, aren't they?
Not in L.A., no. Mm-hmm. I think one did get robbed while I was out there.
There's a movie and or a book in there somewhere.
Yeah. But, like, if you go to L.A. and you see those green crosses, all you'll see is green crosses. Mm-hmm. The green crosses of dispensaries, they're fucking everywhere.
Is Medicare covered? PTSD?
I mean, dude, I got a script. All you got, they also have doctor shops. You just walk in and, like, all they tell you is, like, oh, what do you have? Oh, okay, well, I'll write you a script. And they just write you a script and you just get it. And, like, you could tell them your toe hurts and you get a card.
When I was in... in El Paso, stationed in Fort Bliss, I remember I went to Juarez, and you could buy phenobarbital off the shelf, which is all these people who wanted to commit suicide would go and get their phenobarbital in Juarez. Yeah.
That's what you're saying, like, they're cutting heroin with now? Yeah.
Oh, that's the fentanyl, yeah. That's what everyone is dying from. And when I was in the Army, they had these things, combat lifesaver bags with fentanyl lollipops, and it's basically this thing you put under your tongue, and you could be missing a limb, and you wouldn't feel it. That's why they're... All these kids are dying from overdosing on these drugs.
It's really bad, dude. It's fucking... Yeah.
My brother, he wouldn't mind me talking about it. He was addicted to heroin for a while. When I got back from Iraq, I was riding Rolling Country, and it was Christmas break, and I caught him using heroin. I mean, that was the worst thing I ever...
Literally walked in, caught him?
In the bathroom, he was using it. And he said, well, the stuff I'm getting is really weak, so you don't have to worry about me ODing. And later, he told me I was almost dead when he found me.
Yeah, dude, man.
I understand it. You know, I've been given morphine after surgeries. I take one Percocet per day. The idea of not being in any pain, and somebody said it deals with fear, too, just no pain or no fear. I mean, it's tempting, but the problem is you hit diminishing returns and you got as many problems as before and more.
Yeah. Man, dude, that's fucking...
That's what my book Flash Blood is about. It's basically about this kid who's rumored, he went to Afghanistan and was part of the poppy eradication force in the Army, and he's rumored to have blood that is basically a drug. It's just something I thought about. What if you could be high all the time? What if there wasn't a limit on it? What would be the consequence? It'd be like King Midas, you know, it sounds great, but you fuck everything up.
Yeah. I have to get to that one. That's in my pile. I got that. Dude, I have... My reading pile is ridiculous, man.
Like, oh, yeah, you see my stack of 12 books out there?
It's out of control, dude. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Balancing that is the thing, too, balancing reading and writing.
Yeah, there's always more, too. I mean, it's like crate digging for books or for records.
Yeah.
There's always a good writer you haven't heard of who's good.
I think sometimes it's almost like a hoarder's. I have like a hoarder's mentality about books, where it's like I just have to have more, like, so I can go to the well, like, you know what I mean?
If I was rich, there's a place, ABBooks.com, and you can search by most expensive. If I was rich, I would just scoop up, you know, like first edition of Dracula. I'd be like comic book guy. I'd have like
have all these first edition, like,
what do you call it, the Mylar and the gloves, and I'd go nuts. I'd have a walk-in humidor with like 18th century first edition Chester Himes. Let me see if I can actually do that. Let me find the most expensive Chester Himes novel.
Chester Himes.
Research by maximum price. Okay, highest price. Chester Himes. Have you seen this?
No.
Okay. $1,500. That's not very much. $1,500 for an inscribed 1965 book. Expat. Yeah, he was in Paris with La Crusade de Lee Gordon. That's Lonely Crusade, the one I told you about, where he becomes a communist. $1,500. That's a fucking shame. Black on Black, Baby Sister, Selected Writings. His stuff should be worth a lot more than that. If he hollers, let him go. It's a great...
He's like celebrated in Paris.
Yep.
In France. Yeah.
One Man, that's my favorite book of his, is Run Man Run. Have you read that?
No, I have not read that.
There's it's if you're talking about like haiku, it's basically just this white cop decides he wants to shoot this black guy in the 30s, and they just run through the city, and that's the entire plot. And it's fucking good. I mean, it's just super bare bones, like Driver, basically. I mean, there's very little dialogue.
It's called Run Man Run.
Run Man Run.
I have to check that out. Do you like Dashiell Hammett? Any of his?
Not really. Not really. I mean, not in comparison to
Red Harvest.
I see Hammett, Ross McDonald, and who's the other one?
Chandler. Chandler.
They're all not bad, but I like the crime or the mystery where there's something a little more stranger where the camera isn't in the center, like in Williford. Also, have you read? You've probably seen the movie with Tyrone Power, the Nightmare Alley.
No.
Have you heard about that?
I've heard about it. Yeah. I know what you're talking about, but I haven't read it.
Where it's all based on the tarot cards. He committed suicide in this old hotel in New York. It's really good. And, yep, there it is. Run, Man, Run.
I'm trying to think,
3.5 stars. I fucking hate humanity.
Run, Man, Run. I'm trying to think of the, do you like, blanking on names now. He writes the Easy Rollins novels.
Mosley.
Walter Mosley.
Yeah, he's fucking good. You know, he's better than Mosley, and ooh. I shouldn't compare them. Gary Phillips.
Yeah, I like Gary Phillips.
God
stuff.
Damn, The Juke was one of the best. It's in my top 10 crime reads.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Mosley's great. I mean, Devil in a Blue Dress.
Devil in a Blue Dress is a. I've read that book in one sitting.
Man in My Basement. Have you read that?
Yeah,
that's a good one.
He has that one that it came out maybe 4 years ago, 2 or 3 years ago. Was it Ptolemy? It's like about a guy who has early onset Alzheimer's, mm-hmm. and he's like trying to figure out who murdered or. It's like a murder mystery with a guy with Alzheimer's. He's like running out of time before he loses his fucking memory.
That's very cool.
Ptolemy Gray or something like that. Something of Ptolemy Gray. I think that's, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They made a movie out of that. God damn, what is that old character actor's name? He played the janitor in, not Shawshank, fucking Hudsucker Proxy, who stuck his broom or whatever into the clock to stop it.
Oh.
The Ptolemy something?
Yes, yeah, something of Ptolemy Gray, like...
There's a movie. Oh my god,
yeah, The Last Days of Ptolemy Gray. That's what it's called.
They adapted. Yeah. I know they adapted it into a movie. It's great. There's Samuel L. Oh, he's.
It's a Samuel J. Is going to star in it. Yeah.
I think there's been other stuff. Yeah, the thing about his detective, Easy Rollins, is he was like. He owns some property and he's like a janitor or something, and then he decides to be a detective.
Like he's like this LA like working class detective. You know what I mean?
The movie was not bad with Denzel.
Yeah, with Denzel
Washington. Who shot that?
I can't remember.
The music was really good.
Yeah.
Do you remember?
Carl Franklin. Yeah.
Do you remember Cast a Deadly Spell, where it's a Lovecraft detective film?
I know it by title.
Holy shit! That's crazy.
You know what the thing about Lovecraft with me is, like, I can't get by the fact that he's a fucking racist.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, it's not just that he's racist. It's that people talk about him. They say it's basically, I read a book about him. They said that's the source of his racism is basically his muse, that when he's dealing with all these different species, basically like, Jews and blacks. But yeah. I think before he died, he saw some of what happened in Germany and said, okay, that never mind, I'm gonna back off from this shit a little bit.
That's like one of the things that like separating an artist from the work. Yeah. It's like with Elroy, like some of that, like they say some of it's trolling, but like Elroy's like
James Elroy and his N-bombs all the time.
Yeah, but yeah. I know for a fact that like the dude's just like, that's him, like, you know what I'm saying? Right. Like a lot of that's him. Like I don't know how much, but like some of that, if not all of it, is him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's like I'm definitely a fan, like in terms of like I like American Tabloid and
I shouldn't tell you this, but fucking Scott Phillips
hates
Elroy. He says it's all this kind of like affected sort of beboppy hippity blue blah blah.
Hippity blah blah.
I liked Black Dahlia, but I mean he's too mono maniacal, mono focused on that period in Roy Cohn.
Yeah.
I get it. I think his mom was murdered by a serial killer, so I understand his obsession with that time. But
he does not. I want to say, is it a Salon? There was like a Salon piece written by like one of his, like James Elroy's ex, right, talking about how like she was in love with like a much older man, and it like describes like how he was and like how he's a, like it's a really fucked up like like inside look at like her being this younger woman dating James L.
Hope I didn't alienate Anna too much. I don't need her telling everybody about my problems. Finger in the ass and whatnot. The woman Carol Mallory wrote a lot about her relationship with Norman Mailer. He sounds fucking horrible. I mean, I think he stabbed his wife with a pen at one point.
What about Burroughs shooting his fucking wife?
Have you read his son's books, William Burroughs Jr.?
They say he's super talented. He died. He overdosed and fucking.
Well, he drank
Have you seen the Burroughs documentary?
Yeah.
That fucking shit where like it shows this it shows the details all that shit, but then it shows his son and.
It's sad because his son was one of the first people to get a liver transplant. There's a book called Curse from Birth, Short Unhappy Life of Him. And he wrote two or three really good books.
Really good books, yeah.
But he would go to, like, Tangiers and he'd be, you know, doing hash naked with Allen Ginsberg when he was, like, 12 and shit.
Yeah. Ginsberg. Dude, what the fuck? Ginsberg and fucking Burroughs fucked.
Oh, they did?
Yeah.
I knew they were released by sex.
No, but like that was one of the things in the documentary where they talked about. I was like, what?
Burroughs was gay.
I knew Burroughs was gay, but I didn't know Ginsberg and Burroughs fucked. It's just like the weirdest, grossest looking, like two people you don't want to see fucking.
Usually he had young
together guys. Fucking yeah. Each other. Like, oh my god. It's the weirdest shit. Like they were like Burroughs was such a fucking like I don't know, dude. And that shit the shit he did with the like the cutting,
montages with Brian Geist or whatever.
And shit. Yeah. Like yeah, the fucking like. He was just a bizarre dude.
Somebody met him and they said, that's not a mammal.
I thought they described him as not a mammal.
Not. He is very... something in him, I think, shut down after he killed his wife. I wouldn't go as far as Ebert. When he was reviewing Naked Lunch, he said he's the most pathetic figure in American letters or something. I wouldn't say that. But, I mean, there is something really sad and kind of frozen and shut down about Burroughs.
Yeah,
and I like some of his writing.
Yeah, I think like... It's sad, like, his son was, like, you could tell, like, his son was, like, one of the, like, you said, the shadow thing, being in his father's shadow. Mm-hmm. Like, you could tell, like, he just wanted his dad's approval.
Yeah, and there's a picture of him with his son, and he won't even touch him. There's a writer, Fiona Helmsley, she was telling me, she saw something with Billy Burroughs Jr. He was asking his dad for help, and his dad said, get a job as a pizza man or something.
Yeah. That's in that documentary, too.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, here it is. If you see this in this photo, his dad is. Notice he's looks like he has his arm around him, but he's not.
He's not even touching him. Yeah, so he's not touching him at all.
Something's gone there.
Yeah. Well,
you can't shoot your son's mom and not have some sort of fallout.
And then he had that guy that he hired as his assistant.
Not Brian Geisen.
He was like a twink dude. I mean, that term's not popular, but that's exactly what he was. Like he's like this fucking like. He would like basically sleep with him and be his assistant, and he had a closer relationship with him, and he like than his son. And
They were in New York City, but Burroughs was getting old and kind of frail, so they moved to Lawrence, Kansas, which I think Cronenberg said it was the most boring place in the world.
Yeah, dudes like that, like, and he comes from like this very like affluent family, you know what I mean? Like, and he's just so.
Yeah, Burroughs had some. There's somebody said he was an heir to the Burroughs.
I think
he said he wasn't, but he did get some kind of monthly stipend. I think he got $200.
He was taking like that's what I got from it. I got from it because his father sold the company, the Burroughs company, when it was like worth some fucking money, they cashed out. And then, like, he got some sort of,
He grew up upper middle class in St. Louis, I think.
Yeah, St. Louis. That's
not,
where it was.
Not super rich. He took the cure in Lexington. There was a methadone clinic there that I'm not sure if it's, the building is still there, but that's where all the addicts would go to dry out is in Lexington right across the river.
That's crazy, man. That's fucking crazy. And the guy just, like, people like that, like, the fact that they fucking existed and the fact that, like, you know, he was able to... Like, the shit that he wrote was just fucking Naked Lunch. Like, what kind of... Like, you know what I mean? Like...
It's dated now. At this point, yeah.
Yeah, it's dated really now, weird. But it's, like, for the time. Like, you know what I mean? For the time. And,
about
like...
the sort of talking sphincters and the Dr. Benway and all
that. Yeah. Like, it's just a fucking, like...
There's somebody who was talking about Philip Dick. They say he has two kinds of fans. He has the ones who like him when he saw the bend coming and those who like him when he went around the bend. This is probably... Again, I am square... I like Junkie and Queer. I like his straightforward narratives more than his more sort of surrealist stuff. That's just me. I know that's not what he's known for, but there was a hard-boiled writer struggling to get out of Burroughs. I read some interviews with him. He said, you know, I just read detective novels and mysteries and How to Stop Smoking books. I would have liked to see him just write a straightforward potboiler. I know that'll piss his fans off.
Yeah,
but some of his writing taken in isolation is really good. It's just a cumulative effect. But Cronenberg said, Naked Lunch is like the Bible. You don't just sit down and try to read it cover to cover. You pick it up and read a little bit, and then a little bit later, you know, you take the extracts and the excerpts.
And have you watched the movie?
Yeah, the Cronenberg one. It's unfilmable. I mean, he's one of those writers who, although I heard somebody was trying to make Junkie. I don't know if they made it.
Junkie would be good. It would be a good movie to make.
Yeah, it's one of those things that you have to be really on top of the period detail. It's like Factotum, the Bukowski novel, was really period specific. And then they made the movie with Matt Dillon. It didn't work because it's about a guy who's 4F during World War II, and it's just throwing it in the modern milieu.
Bukowski's one of those guys too, who's like I know people like who like love that dude, and then there's people who just like he sucks.
I like him. I mean, I'm not. I think Ham on Rye is great.
I like that, like, he just, again, I like he's one of those writers, again, who, like, worked at the post office for, like, ever.
Yeah, I mean, if you're talking about paying dues, that guy did not have any advantages.
And just wrote and wrote until he finally became.
There's an adaptation of his work, not Barfly, but it's called Crazy Love by Dominic Duridier. I'm going to mangle his name, a Belgian movie. And it's based on three of his short stories, and it's really fucking good.
The thing have you seen that fucking Bukowski documentary?
The Born Into This?
Yeah, where he kicks his.
Oh yeah, it's a Taylor Hackford film.
Yeah, he like kicks her on camera. Yeah.
What's her name? Linda Lee Beagle.
Yeah, he like fucking like full on like doesn't give a fuck, just kicks this chick.
He says, I'm gonna throw you to the next man or whatever.
Yeah, he just kicks. He like NFL punt. Style kicks at this chick off of the couch.
She worships him, though. I mean, even now. I mean, she knew it was either marry him or have kids, and he already had a daughter. But he was obsessed with this woman he knew when he was younger.
I just like that he's exactly what you think he is. Like, he's just this craggy faced, hangs out in dive bars. I mean,
he had acne vulgaris very bad.
Smoked all the world's cigarettes, drank, like he's just this, just, like, on the surface, this, like, just... like just the ugliest dude, like, and he just writes and he just works the fucking shitty job, and just all of a sudden becomes.
He worked for about 30 years before John Martin rescued him. I mean, he sort of played it to the hilt a little bit too much, with talking about his hard luck stories. Yeah, but I mean, yeah, he definitely had a hard road to hoe. But I mean, he definitely made lemonade out of it though, because I mean it. I gave Factotum to a friend, and he was reading it, and I said, what do you think? He said, this guy led a charmed life. I said, what are you talking about? He's working these shitty jobs. But he showed in his books that you could have these moments of real just fucking pleasure and just, like, joy out of the blue, not even with any reason or ground. Just, you know, the sun would come up, and you would be in your room, and you'd say, oh, shit, I'm alive.
Yeah, that's life. You know what I mean? Like, I think that people discount that. You know what I mean? Like, people are like, well, you know, he but it's like, yeah, but everybody has those moments. You know what I mean? Like, you're just living your life, and you went out, you had a good time. You fucking, you know.
In his view of women, I think, is more complex than the people who bitch about his misogyny think. Yeah, he kicked the fuck out of Linda in that documentary. But I mean,
imagine like that today. Like, imagine if a video came out fucking, what's a famous author? Like, imagine if it was fucking Jonathan Franzen, and that they bring this dude up again.
Oh, yeah,
and he just kicks a bitch in the back.
Yeah, he'd be done.
He'd be over. Like, he'd be crucified, one. Yeah. Like, but the fact that, like, that exists, like, for on tape, like...
The men's rights guys would say if you're alpha enough, you can do it. Like, I think Charlie Sheen was still popular with women after he beat his wife with a lamp and things like that. So, kids, if you want to beat women, get rich and look good.
I just think that's great. And like, I don't think it's great that he kicked her. I just think it's great that, like, we live in a time now that, like, you could look back and be like, holy shit. Yeah. Like, you know what I mean?
Well, she said he only did that once, and she told him after that, if you ever do that again, I'm gone for good.
I don't know about that.
You think
that.
It was a habitual thing?
You think that, like, if he had the balls to do that right then at that moment, like, in front of people, documented, like, that he never had the balls to do it.
Maybe he was showing off.
Maybe he was showing out for the camera.
He did have a persona that was at odds with the private guy.
Yeah.
There was a guy who wrote for
You ever think about that? Like, if you ever got, like, notoriety, would you adopt a persona?
Fuck no. Because I just don't have the energy or the... I don't know what I would be. I mean, it's too obvious to look at me and see I'm boring. I'm just kind of, like, fat and sedentary.
Yeah, but I don't know, man. Like, that shit's alluring, though. You know what I mean? Like,
you get trapped by it, though. This is what Hunter Thompson said. He said people wanted to see the Raoul Duke, the guy with the cigarette and the gun and the on acid.
So. But I think Hunter like tried to live up to that.
Yeah, but he said it was a massive burden. He didn't like it.
Right.
Bukowski used it as an armor. I mean, Bukowski didn't commit suicide.
Right. But you see Hunter's like that.
I see him as a tragic figure. I see him as a guy who had a lot of talent.
And I think that, like, I love Hunter. Like, Hunter's like definitely somebody who's one of my favorite, like, just writers in general. Mm-hmm. But like, there's that list that he put out. I forget what it was in. The one that gets circulated all the time. You see his writing regiment.
Right.
And it's like 12 o'clock. Like, he wakes up in the morning, he's like, I drink Dunlaps or something. Like, his day starts super late.
Right.
Then he's like, he drinks Dunlaps. Then he does, like, and it's like 11 o'clock, do coke. Like it just goes down to him doing, like, coke, fucking mescaline, fucking Dunlaps, fucking smoking some cigarettes, eating fettuccine alfredo, jacuzzi. Like, he's like hours and hours of the shit, and then finally it's like midnight. Time to write, like, you know what I'm saying, like
delay.
Yeah, like all this, like
everything from Hell's Angels to Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, I think is good.
I think he had a period of time, like a really short period of time, where like everything that he produced was like at that moment was just fucking like whatever he was like, that was Hunter, peak Hunter, and then like every after that it was a steady decline to like.
There's
you know what I mean?
There's a saying in German. How would you say? He who makes a wife of the zeitgeist becomes a widow really quickly. Or widower. So writers who were very... Williford was talking about Jim Tully. He's a writer from the 20s. He said he was really big in the 20s. Then what happened? Because he was a creature of that exact moment. So when that moment was over, he was over.
He was over, yeah.
Thompson, rightly or wrongly, is so much associated with... You know, what he talked about, the waves, 68 to, like, 72, where it looked like the revolution was going to happen and it didn't happen, that everything he did before that's good is kind of ignored, and everything he did afterward is kind of ignored, maybe rightly or wrongly.
Nah.
So, I mean, you don't want to be too much a man of your own time, I guess. You want to sort of have your... That's what I like about, say, Jorge Luis Borges or somebody who does magical realism, that your stuff is not pinned to a certain time. It's something that's always... kind of either in the future or in the past.
Yeah, but you gotta look at, like, his life, though. Like, people can say, Hunter definitely killed himself, but, like, Hunter lived a hell of a fucking life.
I think he had a lot of fun.
I mean, you know what I mean? Like, from him...
He became a prisoner of his pleasure, Ebert said.
Yeah, but then you gotta look at the times, like, that shit when he... Remember when he ran for mayor or whatever the fuck that was?
Woody Creek, sheriff,
or whatever the fuck? Yeah. Like, just the crazy shit. I mean, not to mention, like, the shit he did for Rolling Stone, the exposés, you know what I mean? Like,
but his output started being less and less. They said, get him to do this, get him to do that, make him meet the deadline, and he just stopped doing it.
Invented gonzo journalism, you know what I mean? Like,
that happened to Truman Capote. He started going to Studio 54 and not writing anymore.
I think that's like a... Yeah, that's one of those things. It's like it's almost like you become, like you said, a prisoner of your own
pleasure,
or even like you become a character of yourself. You know what I mean? Like,
that's what they said about Hemingway when he wrote Old Man in the Sea. They said it was sort of like him just kind of doing his masculine persona.
I like the sun. What is it? The sun also rises.
Yeah.
And like, wasn't Hemingway impotent? Like, some shit.
I think it was blown off. I think it was blown off. Thought it was impotence, but
because the main character in that is this guy who loves bullfighting. He's impotent. Like the chick that he's in love with is like this woman who sleeps with every fucking buddy. Right. You know what I mean? Like, but him. You know what I mean?
Jack London's early shit is good, but he is a guy like Celine or Nut Hampson or. Goddamn, Kipling, who, you know, is racially troubling if you're looking at it from a 21st century perspective. He talked about, you know, we have to wipe when he was talking about Jack Johnson versus Jim Jeffries, you know, restore the white race, wipe the golden smile off that black man's face, and all that kind of shit. He was a communist, too, I think, for a while. So.
I think, like, it's funny how, like, a lot of, like, writers who are, like, these figures, these historical, like, literary figures, like have these fucking views that are, like, very much of their time.
Yeah, they're probably within the mainstream.
Yeah, that was
not Lovecraft. I mean,
that was mainstream. You know who the one guy who, like, wasn't? Huh. Who was, like, whose work now is even more, kind of, like, super relevant now? Mark Twain.
Yeah.
Like his fucking son, like that fucking that what's that shit? The a knight in.
King Arthur. King Arthur came a lot. Yeah.
Like, where it's just one huge satire about like fucking.
Martin Lawrence did an update on that, didn't he? The Black Knight. That's a bad movie, but it shows.
In King Arthur's Court or whatever the fuck it was. Yeah. That shit is like even now, like it's super, and even his shit, like people like talk about Huck Finn, but like his stance on race and all that shit, like. Like, it's very progressive, like, you know what I mean?
It is more complicated. Like, I was reading something about minstrelsy, and they said they knew that black people didn't behave the way they saw the minstrels behave. What they thought it was, like, elemental man, like, Rousseau, you know, sort of like the natural man, like, they were envious, and it was a way to release their energies through this, and they couldn't, there's a book, Negrophilia, that talks about it, they couldn't, from slave block to pedestal, they couldn't allow themselves to be liberated, so they had to kind of allow themselves vicariously through, you know, not even black people, but white people with burnt cork on their face. It's inexcusable, but at the same time, it's more complex. Now, I don't know, did you see Bamboozled?
Seen Bamboozled.
Yeah, I mean, Ebert said that the images are too charged for it to even work as satire.
I think there's something
to Ted Danson that. Tried.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. I mean, honestly, I mean, you see like right now, like the whole Nat Turner movie.
Yeah.
Like you see like all the controversy that's stirred up, like about it, like it's definitely, and not to mention the rape shit. From Nate Parker's past which, you know what I mean? Like in this era, like if you like
Title IX, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's like fuck, dude. But it's like I think that it's just because. He made a fucking Nat Turner movie.
Right.
And people,
have you seen it?
No, I haven't seen it yet. And I just think that, like, people... That doesn't sit well with motherfuckers. You know what I mean?
William Styron wrote a book. I think it was called The Confessions or The Diary of Nat Turner. He was living with William Baldwin when he wrote it. Mm. Or, no, excuse me, goddamn. James Baldwin. Mm. And Baldwin told him, you know, he'd written some controversial stuff. He said, you're going to be crucified when this thing comes out. It was Styron. I think it may have been pretty controversial. It's about Nat Turner from, I think, his perspective. You know, the revolution... Well, the failed revolution. Yeah, I don't understand the Southern partisan argument because they're racist, but they want black people to be their slaves. That's a pretty intimate relationship. Like, if you don't like somebody, why would you want to be around them 24 hours a day? It's a weird sort of like, I hate you, but I'm obsessed with you kind of shit.
Yeah, yeah, that shit is like, we look at it now, like, I mean, obviously, slavery's fucking terrible, but, like, in the context of then, like, there was a lot of shit that we just don't get because...
It was a way of the world for about 6,000 years.
Yeah, but then also, like, there's this whole weird thing of, like, poor white people
right.
who fought, you know, for the Confederacy,
right.
and, like, they didn't own slaves,
right.
but the fact that they fought wasn't necessarily... They fought basically to protect the interest of the rich people who could own slaves. And the only thing that they were offered and guaranteed was like, hey, like, as long as there's slavery,
you're above somebody.
Yeah. You know what I mean?
I've heard like, people make the counter argument that it affected free labor, so some people hated slavery because obviously if somebody's willing to work for nothing, they're gonna price you out of
your market.
They're
gonna price you out of your market. Yeah.
I'm not sure about that. I do know that your average Union soldier and even Lincoln, until he started having his dreams of his own death, was not fighting to end slavery. It was about whether, you know, they're going to extend the institution into these new territories that were becoming states.
Yeah, like fucking, what was it, the debate? There was a debate Lincoln had.
Douglas.
Was it Douglas? Yeah. Where he said the shit about, like, black people, he did basically more or less that black people aren't equals, you know what I mean? Like, I don't view them, they shouldn't be allowed, and, you know, like, his stances were pretty fucking racist, like, you know what I mean? Like, he didn't believe, he was abolitionist, you know, he wanted to end slavery, but, like, and I don't know how much of that was just, like, he had to say that because that was...
Well, it was practical because he said, I'm freeing the slaves because I wish to deprive my enemy of his material, that's why they would destroy the railroads, and he said... They use the slaves for labor. Mm. Let's free the slaves to fuck up their economy. I mean,
and basically he was more. But what the debate was like? Hey, they're not our equal. You know what I mean? Black people aren't our equal. I don't think they should intermarry. I don't think that they should. Sure. They should be. You know. Basically, he was like it was a segregationist
argument. Sure. Yeah. If you go back to Thomas Jefferson, there's something on the memorial that says there's nothing written in the book of life so certain as that these people should be free. But what they don't tell you is there's a semicolon in the next part of the sentences, and that once free, they should be removed from our society to prevent admixture of the two races. I mean, that's the exact other half
of it. And you know what the fucked up thing is? That's exactly what happened.
Yeah, but I mean, some of it is Greg Fitzsimmons, the comedian, he was talking about it. He says some of it's voluntary. If there's a book, Why Are the Black Kids Sitting Together at Lunch or whatever, you look at sororities or even just in some high schools, people will naturally segregate.
You're going to go to where you feel the most comfortable. You know what I mean? Like, you're going to, the people who I can identify with, you know what I mean?
It's buried deep in the reptilian brain. There's a study shown with mirror neurons when white people are shown, I'm sure you've seen like the racist baby thing on Time. When white people are shown a needle poking into a white hand, they react more strongly than a black hand, and vice versa.
Yeah.
So it's just some sort of deep tribal thing. It's like in Full Metal Jacket, you got this intellect, or any of Kubrick's movies, you have this intellect, and you probably need to use it to advance society, but then there's just a brutal part of man that's just there and might not disappear.
Yeah.
Channeling it, you know, through boxing matches or something, or sports is probably the best idea. But there's no guarantee that society will work out in the end either, so...
Yeah, I think there's, like, you know, like, also, but, like, you gotta look at, like, the conditions in which, like, black people were placed post, you know, the abolishment of slavery.
Right.
Like,
Reconstruction.
Look at just, like, where do you think these ghettos came from? You know what I mean? Like, it was, like, literally, this is just your section of town. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you're not offered the same, like, you're not offered the same level of access to good schools, you know what I'm saying?
The stereotype of, and you, the reason when you drive through the ghetto here and you see the chicken shacks is because when you were in slave quarters, they only had enough space for no real livestock, so there was only chickens. So, I mean, even when you look at, you know, when you drive through the ghetto now, I mean, there's a concept by Mircea Eliade, he's a religious studies, a theologian, he says basically, you're always living in a repeat of another time. There is no such thing as the present and the past. The present is the past. So, I mean, America is, you know, like a racial haunted house.
Yeah, of course. But, that's the thing. Like, I think that, like, people don't... people are so caught up in their own experience.
Yeah.
Like, that a lot of people I know have a tendency to lack the ability to step outside themselves.
Yeah.
Like, and see things. Like all of this, like, non-nuanced opinions on, like, racial issues in this country. Like, everyone's opinion is, like, so, like, unnuanced. It's, like, even when, like, whether it's right or left, like, it doesn't really fucking matter.
Like what do you mean?
Just, like, they want to highlight a problem and say, hey, like, look at these people. Like, look, okay, for example, like, one of the arguments on the right, you know, like, has always been this idea that somehow, yeah, well, the argument is always like, well, black people, look at the crime rate. Like, black people kill more black people.
Right.
And I'm like, yeah, but that's they're violent. Like, look at the situation. But it's like, dude, like, okay, let's look at it from just a simple, like, basic, okay, poor black people, right, juxtaposed against poor white people in this country. Okay, let's look at the different living conditions and living situations,
say, like Appalachia versus
Appalachia. Like, okay, for Appalachia, for example, everyone lives in this fucking spread the fuck apart. Like, you're living in the fucking mountains or in the fucking middle of fucking nowhere. Your nearest neighbor's 2 miles away. Like, have your own land.
It goes back to Durkheim, his theory of anomy, where there was a Genevieve effect. I'm not sure if you heard of it. There was a girl, Kitty Genevieve. She was
nobody did anything.
Urban conditions breed different things in countries.
So you take poor white people who usually, across this country, usually live in these more rural...
They fled over the Rhine. If you look at the migration patterns, whites from Appalachia were... First it was German immigrants, middle class. Then whites from Appalachia came and the Germans moved out.
Right.
Then blacks came from the great migration industrialization, and the Appalachians went to Appalachia.
And if you look at, like, just go to somewhere like the Ozarks or go somewhere like West Virginia and just look at the... Like, people live on haulers. You know what I'm saying? If you step on their land, they'll shoot you type of situation. Now look at, like, poor black people. They live literally stacked vertically on top of each other.
Right.
Like, so when you have a lot of poverty, you're going to have crime regardless. But the conditions in which African Americans live as opposed to poor white people is a very different thing. Like, when you go to the projects in Southie where it's all white, you have similar crime going on in terms of, like, the rates. like of like, oh, like a lot of shit's happening, a lot of people are assaulting each other, a lot of people are because they're on top of each other. But that's a situation where everywhere you go across this country, like, poor black people live in these ghettos and they're all surrounded by each other. Yeah, you have some that are like down south, they're a little bit more spread out, but you even have projects down there like Bowen Homes. Bowen Homes in Atlanta is just a fucking, it's one way in, one way out.
But the urban poor versus rural. Suburban rich, it doesn't fit anymore. I think because of gentrification patterns, gentrification, things like that.
Yeah,
there's more poverty right up the street in Woodlands than there is, say, in two-thirds of Over the Rhine because of what the university's done in that region.
Yeah, but you have to but that's just one example, like, right. of numerous examples of like why, like for example, why are black people locked up at such a high percentage, you know what I'm saying? Like, when they only make up such a small percentage of the population.
Right.
You know what I mean? And that goes into, like, shit like institutionalized racism. That goes into, like...
But then the play devil's advocate. The conservative argument would be to point back to the Patrick Moynihan report,
which
I think was in the 60s. They would say, well, wait a minute. If you... Prior to the civil rights, there were intact black families. The poverty rate was not so high. There weren't so many black people in prison. So it's not saying, hey, let's repeal, let's make black people drink at separate water fountains. They're saying what changed between 1968 and today. They would say it's this is Gavin McGinnis. I'm not sure if he's an alt-right guy.
Yeah, Gavin McGinnis.
He would say,
Gavin McGinnis is very right.
They would say it's a matriarchy, essentially, with black men absent. So what happened? I've heard Afrocentrists say, well, black families were literally pulled apart from each other in the 1860s, right? Mm. That's why you have the high illegitimacy rate. Except after slavery to about 1960, black families were intact. So what happened between there? I'd say deindustrialization is a large part of it. There were, like if you read Mosley's writing, there were aircraft plants in, like, around Compton in the 60s.
Yeah.
You could have a middle class lifestyle as a black person with a high school education in Compton in 1950 to 60. So that's my personal view is I'm not a Marxist, but the racial component can be subsumed in the economic component.
Oh, they're definitely, the economic factor is definitely, again, that's another thing. Like, the access to jobs, right. You know what I mean? That's obviously, there's so many variables that, like, people don't talk about, and it's just like, well, this is the way it is. It's like this because, and it's like, it's never just that. Like, you know what I mean? It's never just, and you just look at it like, okay.
If you're in a situation, you're not going to want to hear someone who's remote from it talking about it. That's a real problem, I think, from the black side for the conservatives. It's like Patrice O'Neill saying, it's like abortion. Women don't want to hear what men have to say. Black people don't want to even hear white people talking about slavery or something.
Yeah, that's true, but, like, I think that, like, honestly, like, it's not even that. That's definitely true.
Yeah.
But it's not even that. It's like, it's almost like people use, we pick and choose. You know, it's confirmation bias. It's like, if I want to see things this way, I'm only going to look for the things that confirm my opinion already.
Well, you don't want to think about people dying and humanize them because it's going to cause you to suffer. You know, I was looking at, I was watching Paul Williams at the fight the other night. You know, he's in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
You know, I was almost crying. You know, you don't want to, if you're going to cry over every person in a wheelchair, that shit's going to hurt.
Yeah.
So if you have to really contemplate every guy who shot like that.
And that's another thing, like, people talk about, like, the people being shot by police.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, from a perspective of growing up in black communities,
mm-hmm.
like, this is not new.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another thing that, like, I think people don't understand. It's like, this is some shit that, like, black people have always been saying this. It's just that we live in a time now where you could actually see it because of technology. Like, the fact that the internet's
body
around.
Cams
body
cams.
Like, everyone has a fucking camera, a smartphone that has an HD camera on it that can upload instantly. Now that people can see this shit, they're like, oh, my God. Like, it was I guarantee, it has always been like that.
Right.
Like, this isn't.
But the question, okay, from the white perspective, I'll just tell you what white people won't tell you. I'll be honest about this. If you look, okay, if there's something like Amadou Diallo, or there's a debate, like they say, okay, maybe police brutality was involved or the cops murdered somebody, and it's in the preliminary stage, white people will understand protesting, investigating, everything like that.
Mm.
But with the Darren Wilson thing, once it's already gone to trial and everything's been done, if you're still protesting something, at that point you're not protesting the officer. To bourgeois white America, it feels like you're protesting the rule of law, and that your only other option at that point is what happened in the wake of the Rodney King verdict, which is fuck the law, there's a recourse higher than law, which is to burn this city or kill people or each other.
Well, my thing is, like, and I kind of, the Kaepernick situation kind of made me post about this on social media and shit, was like, here's the problem. This is from the black perspective.
Right.
Is this is what you're seeing, like, over and over again. Okay, first, they have a problem. Like, people have a problem with Black Lives Matter protest and, like, them blocking highways. And they say, you know, that's not how you protest. You know what I mean?
Well,
like,
the sniping cops is what's pissing white people off.
But, like, but they'll say this, though, too. They'll say specifically this is an uber right position. Okay. Where it's like, where they're like, you shouldn't protest. You can't block highways. That's, like, disturbing the peace. That's, like, impeding on everyone else's. That has nothing to do with it. Okay, fine. Okay, then, of course, then you see riots come out. You can't riot. Like, riot, that's violence. Violence is never the answer, right? So then you see a fucking a rich person of color do a nonviolent demonstration by kneeling during the national anthem.
Right.
And they're like, that's not the way you protest. You never fucking kneel during the flag or disrespect the flag. It's like, okay, what you're basically saying is it's not how someone does it. It's just the fact that they do it at all. And people forget, too. People forget, like, how long do you realize how long it took Martin Luther King and, like, the civil rights movement, how long he was out there. It took, like, over 5 or 6, like, that was, like, 5 years at least. Mm-hmm. Like, the Montgomery bus boycott that started, that boycott went for years.
Right.
Like, they think that, like, we live in this microwave society where, like, stories go, they're gone. But, like, honestly, like, if this is a real problem, which clearly it's a problem, in our country, and it has to do, it's deeper than race. It goes down to, like, fundamentally how we, like, police our people, our citizens, whether they're white or
black. Well, it has to be deeper than race because there was the incident, I think, in Minnesota, Wisconsin, the cop wasn't white. So unless you accept that there's interracial tension
besides
white. It's deeper
than race, but the fact of the matter is that, like, it's sometimes it takes that, like, myopic look at something in order to fix a problem that's greater. And, like, it's the militarization of our police.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? It's the practices in which the way we...
Privatization.
Yeah, privatization, like private prisons. Like, all of this shit, like, this is like, shit that's fundamentally, like, Orwellian.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
The thing is about, what was the guy who spoke at the BET Awards?
Jesse...
And Colin Kaepernick.
Yeah. Mm.
It's like... There's an old saying, those who know don't tell, those who tell don't know. Mm. It's like they're trying to, like Jaden Smith, like they're trying to reestablish a link maybe with the black community because black guys who actually go through this shit are not in their position. You know what I'm saying? Like to white people, they're going to seem, wait a minute, you're just some mixed race guy who...
But people forget, though, like, look at Huey P. Newton.
Mm-hmm.
People forget that.
Well, he grew up in Oakland.
But if you look at Huey P. Newton, that's the fairest skinned motherfucker ever. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Who was the one of the fucking main leaders of the Black Panther Party?
It's not just like paperback test. I'm saying that they're like from privileged backgrounds.
Yeah, but again, you have to take it like it doesn't necessarily matter.
It would be like Reese Witherspoon talking about saving the whales. It's like,
but at the same time, though, they have the microphone big enough to make, like, you know what I'm saying? If they're not offering that.
But it is just, you know, a gesture, too. It's what practical outcome do you think is going? Okay, let's say if you could really snap your fingers and stop police brutality, assuming it's happening at the level they're saying, what practical outcome comes from Colin doing that? Like, what if you said, okay, and let's say every policeman in America has stopped and said, what measures would you like us to implement so that you could feel comfortable standing up and saluting the flag? Because as a soldier, I don't feel comfortable with the flag. I'm not patriotic because of my personal experiences. If he wants to not salute, I don't give a shit. I'm not like a WW2 guy.
Right.
But what could possibly be done to assume that he's not just doing like a gesture? What would do you think he would have, like, something substantive, like a concrete plan? Because you can't just say stop killing black people, because if you're a cop, a black guy pulls a gun on you.
But I don't think guys like Jesse or guys like Kaepernick expect that, like, them speaking out is going to ultimately call. All they're trying to do is open the dialogue. And it's worse.
That's something I hear at school. That's like a human resources term. It's
right.
Like open a dialogue.
But here's the thing, though. Like, we weren't talking about this before. Like, you see now there's multiple players kneeling.
Right.
Like, once it becomes part of, like, it has to become part of the public conversation. It has to. And sometimes it takes a person with a big enough a megaphone.
Right.
That it's going to cause people to talk about it, because we're not going to do shit. It's hard enough to get people to do shit about anything when they're not talking about it.
Do you think the Ferguson effect is real? Do you know about that? that they're saying in black neighborhoods that the murder rate is skyrocketing because white cops are saying, even if I'm in the right, I could end up as a part of a probe or something like that. So maybe I'm just not going to police in black neighborhoods.
Honestly, I would have to look deeper into it. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Because like, it seems like a double bind. Because you say, all right, we're going to police this neighborhood to protect you. And then they say, oh, we're in a police state. You're observing us. Okay, we're going to leave. Oh, you don't give a fuck about us. So
right. It's one of those situations. It's not going to be, there's no quick fix. You know,
I'm not a cop, and I think being a cop is
I don't think anybody can do that job, to be honest with you. Like, I just think it's one of those jobs that's impossible. Like, it's just, I just don't. Like, we need it.
Right.
Like, I'm not one of those people like, we need to just get rid of police. No, of course not. That's absurd.
That's what the South Park guy said. Mad assholes, but you need some assholes.
Yeah.
You don't need people to murder people, you need somebody with an
asshole. It would turn into fucking Mad Max. Yeah. Like, you know, that's what it would be. But what I'm saying is that, like, there needs to be steps taken to, like, whatever the future holds for us in the next 20 to 30 years.
Right.
Like, we need to be on the path to figuring out how the fuck we do this intelligently. You know what I mean? Like, and
people's attitudes. I think people are becoming more balkanized and entrenched. There's a book by Rich Benjamin called Whitetopias, and white people's solution to these problems is not to do what I'm doing, to just maybe counter or argue something.
Mm.
It's just to move further.
Right, move away. Yeah, like white flight.
There are black flight suburbs in around Atlanta as well, where there are just totally black communities, and they feel that black people should be around black people as well. So the solution that people are coming, whatever you're suggesting, whatever Colin Kaepernick is suggesting, the solution that people are taking is just fucking running.
I don't even know what Kaepernick's suggesting. All I know is that he's just speaking out. You know what I'm saying?
But my question is, what do you do after that? You have a bullhorn. One of the problems the Black Panthers had, if you read about it, is initially they started doing a lot of community stuff, grassroots stuff. This is what all leftist movements have a problem with.
Mm.
And then it became more about the pageantry, about you know, the wearing leather and marching and stuff.
Right, and
if
that's
you get caught in the symbol,
and
you
that's
don't
a
do the practical.
Yeah, and that's a human thing. That's a true, you know, like I said, it's tribal, like everything else. Like, you start to identify as this group within a group that represents this. You know, you start to represent these symbols, these things, and it becomes more about that than the actual thing that you began. You know, the whole entire thing began about to begin with. It becomes something else.
Right.
Like, that's just one of those things that, like, regardless of whatever happens going forward, that's something that, like, just being a human being, you have to police yourself.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, not to make a pun about policing, but you know what I mean? Like, there's no easy fix for this shit. This shit runs deep. It goes back hundreds of years.
Yeah, but I mean, the question is there even a complex fix for it? Because you say open dialogue, that sounds human resources.
But if you have to look at it like this, too, like, I like to think of myself as, like, I have pragmatic ways a lot of times, but, like, I'm a fairly optimistic person. People can't make an argument that, like, today in 2016 is far better than it was in 1960 and far better than it was in 1920 and far better than it was in the 1800s when it was slavery.
Right.
Like, we've made a lot of progression in a fairly small amount of time. So, like, if we can get from slaves to a black president within the span of 100 years or so, like, that's huge accomplishment. You know what I mean? Like,
it's not two commensurate trajectories because... all these studies have shown for whites between the ages of like 30 and 55, like suicide is going way up. And they ask them, how do you see the future? It's 60% of blacks say positively, 70% of whites say like negatively. Oxycontin, I mean, drug abuse.
Whites
between 30 and 55 are killing themselves. So if you say, stop killing black people, your average white guy's going to be like, bitch, I'm killing myself right now. I don't have time for this.
Yeah, that's kind of like, I think I've heard like similar shit with the white genocide people, which is the
one. I don't think it's genocide. It's suicide.
No, but there's a whole, have you heard of that? The whole white genocide? I mean, that's weird as fuck. There's people, like, I guess that's, I don't know if it's an offshoot of alt-right, or whatever, but like, there's this whole thing of like, oh, white people are being killed now. Like, it's a white genocide. Like, I don't know if it's just the natural browning of our society because like they say, what is it, like 20 years, like Latino people are going to be the number one.
Yeah, but
like, majority.
I've observed black Latino tension. You know,
that's there, that's real.
Yeah, but for now the people in charge, like you're not the Jesse Jesse Jackson. It still works saying this is the fault of white people. Eventually there aren't going to be any white people. There's still going to be tension.
Right. There's going to be that again.
There's tension between Somali blacks and American blacks in Minnesota.
There's as far as black people and Africans, that's a fucking real thing. Like,
yeah, I've heard about that.
Like black people and Africans don't mix. Like if you talk to them, they're like, a lot of them are like, well, we don't like black people from here and they don't like us.
I saw that even in the army between city and south, they called them like Bamas or some shit.
Yeah. Like there's little subgroups
but,
within.
I should say there's no. I mean, not phenotypically, but I mean, politically, there's no such thing as white people. There's a book, The American Nations by Colin Woodard. He breaks down the 13 Americas. If you look at white people in what they call New Scandinavia, like Garrison Keillor, and compare them to white people in Dixie, and compare them to white people in Cascadia, which is like Colorado and Washington, these people look like each other. They don't agree about anything.
Yeah. But yes, the real thing is, like, the bigger, the larger conversation, I think that, like, that we, like, doesn't get said is because it's the bigger, like, race and all this other shit.
White people won't talk because they're scared of losing their jobs.
Right, but race.
I don't have a job to lose.
This is like this is the argument that, like, isn't the real argument. It's just the argument that we occupy ourselves with, because really what it's about is about haves and have-nots. You know what I'm saying? And it's very beneficial for the people who are, like, running shit for real, for everybody else to be fighting amongst themselves.
Yeah. Do you think it's a conscious plot, or you just think it's the way things have worked out? Do you think they say, let's get them riled up against each other?
I don't necessarily know. Maybe it's a little bit of both. I think the world is essentially ran on chaos. Like, I don't think there's like some fucking cabal controlling it.
Right.
Everything. I don't have that much confidence in humans to be like, we can orchestrate this whole entire world. But I do definitely think that it's super beneficial for a certain class.
Do you think race or class is a bigger identifier for people?
I think it depends on your socioeconomic background and your upbringing. Like, I think for most people, like, it's
look at issues that are massive fault lines, like the OJ. Yeah. That did not break along class lines. That broke race.
That broke race. But I think that, like, I think really, honestly, I think that it's just a class thing for people of privilege. You know what I'm saying?
I mean, if people are eating and their basic needs are met, they're probably not going to tear each other apart. If their basic needs aren't met, they're going to tear each other apart.
Right.
And they're going to organize along ethnic lines to do it.
Right. But I think that, because we all see, like, when it comes to class and money, like, that trumps everything. You know what I mean?
I don't know that it trumps race.
There's definitely racism up, you know, once you climb up the ladder, you know what I'm saying? You definitely see that for sure. But ultimately, I think, like, you know, money greases the wheel. It's the golden rule. Yeah. Like, you know, he who has the gold makes the fucking rules. It's always been that way.
It's
like,
location,
you know what I mean?
Based too. If you have $1 million in Vegas, you have $1 million.
Right.
If you have $1 million in New England, you don't have $1 million.
I think it's about elites and non, you know what I'm saying? That's what I think it's about. Like, it may be different, like, there may be different groups of elite people who like, oh, this person's not in our group, fuck them. You know what I mean? But I think that's what it's a bigger thing is, okay. Like,
here's something you might not have considered, you might even not like it, but let's say the elite are using isolated incidences of police brutality against blacks in order to make black people antipathetic towards the white people in their sphere, like working or lower class whites. Do you think, like, that maybe the elite whites have a black enforcer cased against lower middle class whites or something like that? Because there's something I read about in John Lindsay. He was the mayor of New York, and he said somebody called it the high-low coalition. It's basically like the top and the bottom of society against everybody else. If you look at Rahm Emanuel's, like, Chicago or Dinkins, from about the 30s to the 80s, Democrats have had total power in Chicago, but it's still like a war zone.
Yeah, it's a war zone. Yeah.
I don't know whether Obama feels loyalty to people there. I don't know him personally. But I mean, nothing has been. I have a friend who grew up, you know, Wild Hundreds, whatever, in the South Side of Chicago.
South Side, yeah.
And shit. So even when there are no conservatives or Republicans in the equation, and you have one party rule for 70 years, it's still bad. So I mean, it's
like I said. There's no, like, you know, it's a mess. Dude.
I don't doubt that It looks from our perspective like power is being redistributed.
Yeah.
That's probably where those white people afraid of genocide are getting it, because watching TV and stuff or looking at athletes or the president, the power behind the throne is still pretty much just a small number of white people.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not obvious about it. So regardless of, I will concede that those at the top are doing it, but the only white people that, say, black people in the ghetto have access to are just like cops and like fucking lower class white people. It's frustrating, I think, because Patrice O'Neill said you can't have slavery and all of these things and then have a white guy who didn't do it and put him in front of us because we need somebody to say, you like, just have a white guy on a unicycle who was responsible for slavery, you'd be like, you did it, motherfucker. But it's confusing to have somebody in front of you who didn't enslave you, but it, you know what I'm saying?
It's they still represent that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say. Basically, Colin Quinn said, you give a 20-year-old white, okay, you have slavery, you tell black people the system are against them, and then you tell a 20-year-old white guy, hey, here's a really fast car and a gun. Go up to these black people and say, hey, open up your trunk. I represent the system. Well, I mean, it's not going to work for either party.
Right, right, right. I just think, like, man, like, I think, like, these issues are just, they're a product of, like, years and years of fucking just...
Centuries.
Yeah, centuries. I mean, like, centuries and centuries of fucking just inequality. But it's, like, it's a human thing. You know what I mean? Like, it's a human thing. Like, we're tribal in nature. Like, we are. Like, and that's
humans just, are going to try to get power over each other.
Yeah, that's what they do. They're gonna. You put a bunch of people, like, it's the Stanford Prison Experiment. You give those. They gave those.
The milligram.
Like, you're gonna. People are gonna get in power. They're gonna abuse it. They're gonna fucking dice people up into little groups and, you know.
Do you know about Mouse Utopia? There was this. There was this experiment they did with these mice, and what started happening is a lot of these mice started withdrawing from life, and they became the beautiful ones. They would groom each other and enjoy their lives, but they didn't have children. They stopped fighting. There's a whole swath of men at this point who are just like, all right, Netflix, porn, weed, video games, I can't do this life shit. And it's just a massive swath. I don't know racially how it breaks down, but it's just, it's an age thing. There's a large swath who just aren't doing marriage or society anymore. Superfluous males.
I think that, like, that's a generational thing as well, you know what I mean? Like, definitely a product of, like, the modern, you know, era. Like, I think it probably breaks across color lines. It may be more white, maybe, possibly. I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was just...
Well, beta male rage is mostly a white thing. Regardless of shootings in general, when somebody dresses up as a Joker and shoots somebody, you know it's a white guy. That's what the Keith Robinson says. You know which kind of crime it is.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. The emasculated white dude.
Beta male rage. They call it, I forget what they call it in China, because there are so many men who can't have children that they go to, like, kindergartens and just start spraying.
Shooting. Yeah. Yeah,
like the, what's a kid, Newtown, sort of like that. So.
Oh, God. Yeah. I mean, like, I just look at it like, fuck the race shit. Like, if you just look through human history.
Right.
Like, look at fucking, like, who the fuck decided one day, like, oh, I'm royal. Fuck that. Like, I have the army. Yeah. Like, I have the might. So guess what? I'm gonna build a castle. I'm gonna rule all you motherfuckers. I'm a king. And everybody that descends from my bloodline is royalty. Fuck you. That's just made up shit. But people do that.
It took a long time to get there. It was fighting. It's like boxing. Yeah, I mean, it starts
like, you go all the way back to fucking, I guess, when we were walking around and fucking living in caves.
Right.
Like, you know, and people break into little groups. There's the alpha male, the guy who fucking, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
And then, but like, as we evolved and become more sophisticated societies, like, we started to do, it's just the same shit.
There are checks and balances, though. If the alpha gets too out of control, the betas will gang up on him.
And then it's a fucking, then they reinstate a new alpha. But it's the same shit. It's like, who, like, the royal family, like, they're not fucking any different from any fucking person walking around.
Well, sometimes
it's just that
the
long time ago,
thinned and
but just it's
diseases.
Just a long time ago, their fucking great 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 ancestor decided, I'm about to take over all this shit because I can.
Right.
And it's like the same thing, the same mentality is applied in this country. It was applied during slavery. Look, we can go get these African motherfuckers in Africa. They live in tribes.
No. That didn't. What? This is where the Alex Haley thing gets involved.
Yeah.
He said, you know, that they would come to Africa in nets, and this is where the racist right wingers actually have it partly right. The slave channels were opened up by tribes warring.
Yeah, warring tribes.
So,
but yeah,
they were
no, that's what they call. That's what the whole term Sambo came from. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like these other Africans.
Sell out or something.
Yeah, like they would sell these other motherfuckers into slavery because they were like, hey, this is warring tribes, and we would try to get rid of them.
Right.
But the fact is that, like, you had that going on again, which is people vying for power, territory, whatever reasons they had. And then you have another race of people come in and take advantage of it. Like, hey, fuck it. We'll just take all these motherfuckers. Mm-hmm. They're different from us anyways. We'll take them. We'll enslave them.
Right.
And now you're less than us. You know what I'm saying? Now you do what we fucking say. It's like, yes, a different situation, a different scenario, but it all stems from that same, like, those same, like, those primal, you know what I'm saying, that need to lord over people. When you give people power over people, they just go fucking too far.
Well,
the
Afrocentrists would say, I don't know if you've ever read any, like, Nation of Islam-y stuff. I've read everything on the right and left, trust me. Like,
yeah.
But, I mean, they would say it was because the white man is like genetically recessive, and he's afraid of everybody.
Like about like Yakub, all that shit. So they try to conquer people
because they're afraid of him.
Like that. The Yakub created white man. Yeah. It was like a fucking
island of Patmos.
That shit is like next level. Like, you know what I'm saying? That's like, yeah, that's like the Nation of Islam shit. Yeah, I'm familiar with that shit. Like, yeah. I get it in terms of like, yeah, they're gonna create these stories for, you know, it's about, you know.
Well, nothing's bullshit that works if it keeps you from like Malcolm X, if it keeps you from doing drugs.
I'm gonna be honest with you. I like Malcolm X.
He got out of that shit.
But even Farrakhan, who said a lot of shit that I can't even be like, yo, dude, like, he said some fucked up shit. He's done some. He might have been fucking responsible for Malcolm X's murder.
John Henry claims he was.
But like, you know, to say that he had some sort of hand in play, yeah, he probably did. Most likely, I don't know. But the fact of the matter is that, like, and he believes all of that shit. But he does have some valid points. You know what I'm saying? Like,
he's not stupid.
He's not a stupid man at all. Like, there's a lot of shit. There's merit to some of the shit he says. Like, you can't co-sign everything he says. A lot of the shit he says.
No, I think he said he was abducted by a spaceship at one point.
Yeah. He's had some wacky shit. You know what I'm saying? Like, we all have our wacky shit. Yeah. You know, and I don't excuse none of that shit. Like, I just say that, like, he does make points from time to time that I do fucking agree with. But the fact is that, you know.
Have you heard Pastor James Manning?
Oh, my God. That dude.
He's all the way out there. Ministries.
Yeah.
Obama, the Mac Daddy.
Yeah, he's pretty.
I don't know. I mean, yeah, all of these insane people are interesting. But, I mean, what is. At the end of the day.
What it is you get a charismatic person in a position of fucking. Give them a forum in order. And, like, they're going to attract, you know. They're going to attract legions of followers. Like, we see it over and over again. You know what I'm saying? And, like, a guy like him put in that position, you know what I'm saying?
Manning or Farrakhan?
Either. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? They're going to attract. You look at fucking, like, Cincinnati's own fucking Charles Manson. Like, he was able to talk people into murdering people. You know what I mean? Like all it takes is one kind of crazy motherfucker with a little bit of personality to say the right kind of words to the right set of impressionable people, and boom. Like, you know what I mean? Like, Even if it started out as somewhat good intentions, you're still somebody who's sort of crazy or not all the way full-blown fucking crazy. It's only a matter of time before some crazy shit goes down. It's only a matter of time before I use you to, you know, to do some you know, we're just, humans are fucking monkeys, dude. Yeah. We're fucking monkeys, and, like, that's what it is. Like, this is ape shit.
Yeah, there's a book, Demonic Apes, that talks about this, basically, that apes and the origin of human violence.
Did you ever you read any, like, Terrence McKenna shit? Like, the stoned ape theory and all that shit?
I don't think so. Demonic males is apes and the origin of human violence. Yeah, I mean,
like, that, like, basically, like, they think that, like, humans descended from apes who ate psilocybin mushrooms and shit. Like,
oh, no.
Like, basically, like, because they said, like, back in, like, they would eat them off the cow patties. Mm-hmm. And, like, a certain, like, whatever, the psychedelic... Whatever the psychedelic effects of them eating these mushrooms continuously all the time, getting fucking, it changed and altered the brain chemistry of these apes, and then the next evolution became like man, like, you know what I'm saying?
One thing that Afrocentrists are right about, I think, is they've done tests. I think whites have more Neanderthal DNA. Mm-hmm. So when they talk about the caveman and Marcus Garvey talks about living in the caves and things, I think whites do actually. I mean, you see it in the hair. Yeah. Whites do actually have a higher proportion of Neanderthal DNA. Caveman.
The fact is, like, we don't know shit. Like, you know what I mean? That's
human genome hasn't really been mapped. They don't understand it.
But, like, people don't even... We don't even have an accurate view of, like, human history. Like, because there's also other things out there, like, well, we can trace all of human civilization back to, like, Africa. Mm-hmm. But that's assuming that, like, there wasn't a prehistory history. Like, because there's evidence of all these massive, like...
They're saying Vikings were in North America possibly.
But also, there's this evidence they've been finding of, like, massive asteroidal impacts that literally could have reset human society. Like, and the only reason that everyone can be traced back to Africa is because those were the sole survivors.
That was the last reset.
So there was other, you know, there were other people, but they got wiped the fuck out. Right. You know what I mean? That's like from them explaining the dude who found water erosion on the Sphinx. Mm-hmm. And they're like, wait a minute, it didn't rain. If that means the Sphinx has to be older, because the last time they can date that the rain was like 10,000 years before what they think the Sphinx was built.
What do you think of the Eric von Däniken, the stuff that's gotten done with Prometheus and the guy with the hair on the History Channel, the Ancient Aliens.
Oh, Ancient Aliens. that dude's awesome, one. Yeah. He's fucking awesome.
I think
awesome.
He has a BA in physical fitness or something.
Yeah, like that shit goes crazy, but, like, I do think that, like, I don't know necessarily if we were made from aliens. I don't know if, like, you know, people want to talk about the Anunnaki and ancient Sumerian texts.
Yeah, they say in the Bible that when they're talking about the Nephilim or whatever, that they're talking about in these massive floods, they're talking about these explosions and... alien craft.
Like, I think that, like, honestly, I think that, like, if you really look at it, like, there is maybe human civilization built up to a point where we were actually, like, a sophisticated technologically advanced society, and, right? And boom, reset. Like, it could happen. Like, because if you think about it, if there was structures, the only things that would be around would be stone. Like, if you left a car out in here and just left it for 100, it would be gone within like a century.
Right.
Like, it would rust up and got. None of these structures would. If we cease to exist right now, just give it a century or two, most of this shit would be gone.
Most of this is particle board. I mean,
right, right. The only things that would be there would be these massive stone granite structures, like Göbekli Tepe. You ever heard of that? Like, that's that massive. I think it's in Turkey.
Oh. Yeah.
Like, it's like, it predates all of what science.
In Iraq, I saw the Ziggurat of Ur. It's in the Bible. I was in Talil. Of Ur, it's where Abraham was born, or something like that. It was built to an ancient owl goddess or something. Anyway, I was stationed like 50 feet from this fucking thing, and the Americans had set up a Pizza Hut and a Subway and a Burger King.
Right, the most American shit you could ever do.
Right next to the Ziggurat of Ur. We were one of the last groups that was allowed there. There were some soldiers. We were one of the last groups to tour it because people started breaking pieces off. So, I mean, you can kind of see where the fucking terrorists are coming from. You don't want to see Abraham's birthplace. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was in Talil, Nazaria.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, I did feel the, like, ancient eeriness of it while I was there.
Yeah, man, like, I just, you know, like, we got off on, like, this tangent, but I just think that, like, you know.
I enjoy it, man. I don't usually talk. I mean, I'm usually just here by myself reading, listening to music.
You know, I just find it, like, I find it, like, most people don't even entertain, like, the idea, like, hey, like, there's multiple viewpoints and multiple valid positions that people take on the same, you know, on one issue. Like, right. You know what I mean? Like you're not going to solve, we're not going to solve racism, right. Like, just because, you know, like, all of a sudden we've had this mass awakening of, like, oh, like, this shit's real. You know what I mean? Like, in 2016, like, it's gonna take time, like, but I think that honestly a lot of this shit has to happen. As fucked up as it is, it's like, sometimes, like, that's the only thing that we respond to, is just like, we have to have, like, public unrest. You know what I mean?
I think even if we all became sort of like the 2040 cafe au lait society, people would find, if you look at the IRA in Northern Ireland, the Protestant versus Catholic thing, they all look exactly like each other. People will find it.
Yeah, like, that's fucking.
They'll find a reason to kill
Rwanda, like the Tutsi and the Hutu.
I think there was a height difference between them.
If you looked at them to the layman, to anybody outside of that culture, you could not tell the difference between these fucking people to save your fucking life, but they could.
Yeah.
They knew it, and they were fucking killing each other over it. You know what I'm saying? And that's just straight up African people. That's who we are.
I think I can afford to take a dimmer view, because usually when we talk about these things, you take a more positive view. I think you have kids, right?
Yeah.
You should. I mean, I don't know.
That's the thing. It's like, you have to think positive.
I think about suicide, so I think.
Because it's like, because it's like, yeah, they're the, like, when I'm gone, they're still going to be here. Right. You know what I'm saying? So that's one of the things.
That's what I'm saying.
But I also think, though, like, I have a kind of a view where, like I said before, either we're going to, like, get to a point where we just destroy everything, or we're going to reach a point of enlightenment, and it's kind of a race to see what happens first. You know, and depending upon your view of, like, how you think, like, you're going to lean one way towards the other.
Well, one group views the other's enlightenment is right. Like, stupidity and destruction. From each perspective, things don't scale. So it's like, you know, one man's dream, another man's nightmare.
Yeah, you know, and I just think that, like, on some level, I think that, like, we live in a time now where, like, it's we're more connected and disconnected at the same fucking time, and it's very weird. Like, we're more aware of each other in the world now, but we're also more cut off because of, like, the access is, like, still, like, I can see somebody Facebook Live from London, like, right fucking now.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I'm by myself. I'm, like, looking at a fucking screen.
Yeah.
So it's like, you're more connected, you're more aware, but you're also more disconnected. Like, it's more impersonal. So it's like this weird, like, we don't know how to process that. You know what I'm saying? Like, we're still trying to figure this shit out.
Nobody knows exactly what it's doing to the brain.
Right, we don't. We don't.
It's all new territory.
We don't know. Like, I know that, like, the human brain is not, like, how many people do they say you can remember? Like, 150 or some shit? Like, something like that. We can only remember up to a certain amount of people. Like, our brains, we're going to have to, like, hack into our minds and fucking find like more storage or some shit.
They've,
you know what I mean?
Actually, they mapped the human brain. There's a human brain. Let me see.
We're gonna have to have like fucking Xbox hard drives in our brain or some shit.
I have this.
That's why people keep saying, like, you know, like, biotech is the future.
How to create the mind, the secrets of human thought revealed. Basically,
Ray Kurzweil. Yeah, Kurzweil. Yeah.
Is that what you mentioned?
Yeah, well, he's one of the guys who, like...
reverse engineering the brain to understand...
Kurzweil believes that, like, he's the big about the singularity and all that shit. Basically, like, is he the one that describes, like, human beings as being, like, the sex organs of machines?
Right, post-human.
Like, basically, like, our urge for... like, the human urge for, like, constant, like, like, you know how, like, we're constantly wanting upgrades and, like, we're wanting to continuously push to have more, you know, like, it's fueling the creation of artificial intelligence.
It's Moore's, have you heard of Moore's Law? Moore's Law of exponential returns. It's basically, if you look, exponential, basically, okay, radio came out, you had 30 years before television to kind of navigate it and learn it.
Yeah.
Television came out 30 years till internet. Internet came out. Every 6 months, there's a revolutionary leap in speed that doesn't give you time to process what's going on. Gordon Moore's law of exponential growth in the singularity basically means we no longer have time to process what's happening to us or what we're doing to each other or ourselves.
Yeah. It's
with the computer. I've read studies that say people's brain matter, the gray matter has changed because of masturbating with pornography on the internet. It's like the mouse in the Skinner box who keeps pushing for the cocaine pellet or something.
No.
So, I mean, we've altered ourselves. Not everybody does that, but I mean, human beings have altered. It's not just that. People get gratification from the
Kurzweil,
little Facebook.
I think Kurzweil, though, is like one of those also believes like the merging of humans and machines is going to happen. Like, you know what I'm saying?
The transistor.
Yeah.
Basically, here's from 1971 to 2011. It's gone from a transistor count of 2,300 to 2.6 trillion. I want to say. Somebody said there're going to be more microprocessors than there are grains of sand on the earth, or something like that. And they're going to be more.
That's fucking insane.
The internet. Have you heard of the Internet of Things? Did you talk about it?
No. What's that?
It's basically everything is going to be the internet.
Everything is the internet. Yeah. But you know what?
You will be part of the internet.
That's the simulation theory too. Like basically we're all, this is just a simulation. You know what I'm saying? It's already happened.
The internet is a mutual hallucination, is basically what it is.
Yeah, right. And like we're already, like it's already happened. Like all this shit that we're talking about has already happened.
Just out of curiosity, let me see. It's the most expensive book. Do you like Gibson or?
I'm vaguely familiar with him. I don't, you know what I'm saying?
So. Yeah, his most famous film work was Johnny Mnemonic.
Oh, yeah, Johnny Mnemonic.
But Neuromancer was his big breakthrough. See, that's fucking insane. $38,000 for Count Zero.
$38,000?
Neuromancer was basically the kind of his coming out. 25 grand. Chester Himes was expensive. It was 1500. Give me a right. Let me look at Charles Wilford. I'm going to be pissed by this.
Charles Williford is one of those guys who's not really...
It won't be up there. It'll be like 1,500 or something. 9,500. Okay.
He's like not well known. You know what I mean? Like.
He's more writer's writer.
Yeah, writer's writer.
All right, let's look. J.D. Salinger, 64,000. Catcher in the Rye.
Catcher in the Rye.
But that's because he did so few personal inscriptions. Like the most expensive, Hunter Thompson. Probably nowhere near that. 30,000. Jacket. Oh, it's a jacket that was done by Ralph Steadman. Holy shit.
$12,000 Fear and Loathing campaign, Trail 72.
Hell's Angels.
11,000. Yeah. That book's hard to find, honestly. The Hell's Angel one.
Oh, I think it's on. I had it a while ago.
I think it's hard to find as far as, like, you can't go into somewhere and get it. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
Like a reissue copy. You can't, like, it's like they don't carry it for whatever fucking reason.
Is Sonny Borger still alive?
The head of the Hell's Angels. He wrote his own book. Sonny Barger did. I didn't look too too fucking good, honestly, for us.
Oh, yeah. He and Thompson did not get along.
Yeah, they didn't get along. That whole fucking shit about Thompson getting beat up and shit. And,
oh, yeah, wait, well, Barger kicked a dog or something, and Thompson said, you're a coward.
You're a coward for kicking a dog, and then they kicked his ass, and, like, fucking... They had that whole... He had that whole fucking... he went on... What show was that when the biker dude came on? He actually rode into the studio on the chopper.
Oh, yeah.
And he was like...
Oh, yeah, Dick Cavett.
Was it the Dick Cavett show?
Well, it was either that or, like, Steve Allen. There's a... If you want to learn where fucking... Nobody knows this, but Hunter Thompson got his start from a guy named Lionel O'Leary, was his main influence. And
didn't he used to write, like... He used to, that. Like, type Fitzgerald? Like, what was it? Like, Fitzgerald... Or was it Fitzgerald?
Oh, I think Great Gatsby just write it.
He just write it over and over and over and over again until he got, like, that's how he taught himself how to write.
That book was not popular when it came out.
Yeah.
It was, they started bungling it with these, like, morale and welfare thingies for soldiers in World War II. Yeah. Because it was so short, it became popular that way when it came out. Great Gatsby, $300.
Jesus. $377,000.
Oh, we can get higher than that, man. Let's look up William Shakespeare.
It'd have to be, like, an actual, like, original...
Spell his name on the moron. 500.
Half a million. Yeah. Half a million. That makes sense, though.
James, it's in New York City. Rob this fucking guy. London, 1664, third folio edition, second
edition. You know what? Like, you know, that's always, like, a plot for a movie. It's like, oh, we're going to get this horse for money. But where the fuck would you be able to sell that? Like, I don't know the connects on the black market to sell that. You know what I mean? Like, if I had a $500,000 fucking...
That's what happens. They get away with it, and then they draw fire when they're trying to sell it. That's why fences only pay you 10%.
10% of what it's worth. Yeah. You'd have to find, like, some eccentric billionaire that wants to own the copy. You know what I'm saying? And
did you see The Ninth Gate?
The Polanski movie with Johnny Depp.
It wasn't that shit.
Yeah,
Gutenberg Bible, you cannot, it's so expensive you cannot purchase it. You can purchase a sheet for like $7,000.
Gutenberg Bible.
Yeah, I mean, it came off the first printing press ever. Let's see, Martin Luther,
the first translated fucking Bible.
$140,000.
I thought it would be higher than that, honestly.
Let's think. Who is the most famous? Maybe Bram Stoker. Dracula for a while was the best-selling novel of all time. 75? First edition, 1897. I've actually seen that before. It's just the yellow jacket. It's nothing to write home about.
Somebody who you like.
Somebody that I like? Yeah. I'm trying to think of a fucking author of note whose books would be considered rare or worth money. What's the most expensive? Larry Brown. Probably won't be high at all.
I'd say like 1500. Let's see,
Thomas
the Road, just out of curiosity. He's exclusive or whatever. Pretty large.
$31,000 for the. What is that? If you could. What is it? Stephen King, Ray Bradbury. What?
Oh, it's first edition. It's probably one of his first short stories that sold to something that had Ray Bradbury. Mm. Dark Tower Gunslinger.
$25,000. The whole set. Yeah. Fine.
Look up Rage by Richard Bachman.
the pen name.
$1,000. New England, 1983. Now that we'll fucking appreciate because it's not getting reprinted.
Yeah.
There's the original cover. The problem was complex. The solution, killingly simple. I'm sure that's a correct adverb, killingly. Yeah, he pulled that one. You see Bachman's running there. Large.
I could Jesus Christ, dude. Yeah, that was only 540. That's
I tortured myself with this three times already. The good people at Collier's Magazine.
Alright. What time is it, dude?
Well, 1:20.
Alright, let's wrap it up. It's cool, man.
I enjoyed it, man.
You know, I enjoy talking. You know what I'm saying? Like,
I'll take my Ambien now.
Yeah.
Let me.
This isn't too bad for somebody with as many problems as me. 5 drugs.
Cool.